take your seats. Here we go. Good morning. It's 9:02, and I take this meeting to order of Academic Research and Student Affairs. Catherine Riley, will you please take roll?
Chair Arizcata.
Chair.
Vice Chair Downs.
Here.
Regent Bautista. Regent Brown.
Present.
And Regent Del Carlo.
I'm here.
You have a quorum.
Thank you, Ms. Riley. Regent Del Carlo, will you please lead us in a Pledge of Allegiance? Thank you all. Before beginning, we take a moment to recognize that here in Nevada, we stand on the land of the Washishu, the Washoe, the Numu, the Northern Paiute, the Nui, the Western Shoshone, and the Nuwu, the Southern Paiute. We take a moment to recognize and honor their stewardship that continues into today. With this recognition, we state an intention to rightfully include their voice and respect them as the 27th sovereign nations of Nevada. SCS, this is Systems Office in Reno, and we have a significant trouble feedback, bad connection for all audio. We have reverb going throughout our office, and I know that the SCS gentlemen up here are trying. Thank you. All right. Hopefully you all can still hear me down there. But for those who would like to call in and offer public comment, please dial 669-444-9171 and enter meeting ID 992-8475-3091 with passcode 555-5555. So we're going to start off with public comment at GBC. Is there any public comment at GBC?
There is no public comment at this time.
Thank you, GBC. And I know that there is public comment in Reno, so please may we hear from public comment at the Reno office.
My name is Grace, G-R-A-C-E, McAndrews, M-C-A-N-D-R-E-W-S. I am an ASUN senator for the College of Agriculture, Biotechnology, and Natural Resources and an undergraduate student studying rangeland ecology and management. I am here today to express my strong support for Provost Thompson's proposal to establish a College of Veterinary Medicine at the University of Nevada, Reno. This proposal responds to students' needs by investing in student opportunities and building upon infrastructure we already have. Investing in students means investing in Nevada. Through my role as cabinet senator, I have the opportunity to hear directly from students. A recurring theme is students need more opportunity for applied experience to remain competitive after graduation. While students must seek these opportunities, universities must provide the resources to make this possible. Nevada students should not have to leave Nevada to serve Nevada. Initiatives like this respond to student needs by expanding pathways for opportunities while helping our university stay competitive and better prepare students for professional and academic opportunities after graduation. Simultaneously, this allows UNR to build upon infrastructure that is already at our fingertips, like Main Station Field Lab. As both a senator and a student, I strongly support the proposal to establish the College of Veterinary Medicine at UNR. I encourage this committee to support this proposal as investment in students, because investing in students is investing in Nevada's future.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Joseph Guild, G-U-I-L-D. I'm a lawyer here in Reno for over 40 years. also a past president of the Nevada Cattlemen's Association, a proud graduate of the University of Nevada in 1969 here in Reno, past president of the Nevada Agricultural Foundation, and the current co-chair of the Kavner Dean's Advisory Committee. I'm also a ranch manager, and I own a small herd of cattle with a partner in northeastern Nevada. I'm here to urge your support, board, for the creation of school veterinary medicine and for the reasons stated by Grace before me. I would echo what she said. As a ranch owner, it's over the past four or so decades and managing ranches, I've seen a decline in the number of veterinary doctors that we have here in Nevada, particularly large animal vets. But the creation of a veterinary school would not just be limited to large animal veterinary medicine. It would benefit all of Nevada, in my opinion, including the large urban areas, southern Nevada and here in northern Nevada. So I urge your support. I've had conversations with Provost Thompson and President Sandoval. I stand ready, as does the Dean's Advisory Committee, to aid in this effort in any way possible. Please support this effort, and thank you, by the way, for your service as members of the Board of Regents of the State of Nevada. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gilt.
My name is Dr. James Banky, B-E-A-N-K-E.
Mr. Banky, Mr. Banky, Mr. Banky.
Yes?
We're going through public comment here at the Reno office. Then we're going to go to the CSN main board office. And then we're going to be taking public comment through the phone right after that. So if you could hold off, Mr. Banky, we'd greatly appreciate it. Thank you much, sir. Public comment from Reno, please continue.
Good morning. My name is Zach Wells, Z-A-C-H-W-E-L-L-S. I'm a undergraduate student studying rangeland ecology and management here at the University of Nevada, Reno. I'm the current president of the UNR Range Club, and I'm a former agriculture ambassador for the College of Ag. I am here to voice my support for developing and building the School College of Veterinary Medicine at the University of Nevada, Reno. As an ag ambassador, I can tell you firsthand, talking to producers whenever we go out to engage with the state, there's a massive there isn't a job. There are not sufficient veterinary doctors in Nevada. I can also talk about, from the student perspective, we deal a lot with 4-H and FFA. So many students that are born and raised in Nevada are being sent out of state and then taking their skills and trades out of state to build lives there because they can't do it here because our state is not currently supporting them in their educational needs. This is the opportunity that the state has to give Nevadans what they need all across the state, whether they're upcoming students, whether they're ranchers, whether they're families that just have animals. We have a shortage of vets everywhere. I would also like to point out that this supports the Wolfpack Rising Strategic Plan from 2023 through 2027, specifically with the goals of investing in our future, leading for Nevada, and expanding the Wolfpack impact. This impact won't just touch Nevada, it will touch the western United States and likely all of the United States. Additionally, this supports our Success by Design Strategic Plan that NSHE has implemented. This would actively this would help meet Nevada's workforce needs, support student success, and improve access to higher education for all Nevadans. We really, really need this, and this is the board's opportunity today to listen. We're just going to continue hearing how short we are on vets. We are stressing this. This is important. Please listen. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. And I was remiss not to mention that these public comments are for 2 minutes apiece. 2 minutes apiece. Next public comment here in Reno, please.
Hi, my name is Carla Martin, K-A-R-L-A-M-A-R-T-I-N.
We're going to hold off on public comment from the phones. If all public comment from the phones could pump the brakes and hold off, we'd greatly appreciate it. And I'd really appreciate if SDS could figure out how to mute those on the phone as for right now until we get to them. It'd be also really appreciated. We're going to continue having public comment from the Reno office, and then next will be the CSN meeting site. Please continue from here in Reno.
Hi, my name is Miriam Dayton, M-I-R-I-A-M-D-A-Y-T-O-N, and I serve as an ASUN senator for the College of Liberal Arts, and I'm an undergraduate student at UNR studying economics and Spanish. I think it's really important to get a perspective outside of the School of Kavner, because I think this is a program the veterinary school will impact positively the entire Reno community and those in the Wolfpack. I'm extremely excited by this prospect. Not only does the vet program provide more graduate school opportunities for students at the university, it will also help the community to have a student vet clinic available. Further, as an economics major, I'm convinced that having a veterinary grad school here will help prevent brain drain in Nevada. Currently, students who aspire to be veterinarians need to go out of state for graduate school and are thus less likely to return to Nevada, which is a disservice to our state. It will benefit the animal population, local economy, and veterinary population in Nevada to have a graduate program available. Even though I have no intention of going to veterinary school, and it is not the intended plan of many of my classmates in my college, I firmly support this program as I believe it will further add to the prestige of UNR and ultimately benefit all students, regardless of their field of study. Also, animals are cute. Thank you for your time.
Well stated. Next public comment, please.
Hi, my name is Luna Cannon, L-U-N-A-C-A-N-N-O-N. I am a veterinary science major. I am a University of Nevada Reno student ambassador. I am a Kavner ambassador, and I am a program ambassador for AVRS. And to sort of go off of what many of my peers are in agreement about is that this veterinary college opening will give opportunity not only to the university but to the people of Nevada. UNR is a Tier 1 research university. That means everything we do has a foundation in research. And our research, I know me and many of my peers, our research stops at the undergraduate level because we just don't have the support for further projects. And implementing a veterinary school would allow our projects to grow, and it could increase not only the amount of funding that Nevada can receive as a state, but it'll also increase the amount of projects related to Nevada and the support Nevada students can give back to the state itself. UNR is also a financial option for a lot of students. As a student ambassador, I speak with a lot of prospective students, and a driving force for choosing UNR is the financial stability of the university and the financial aspects, and providing a veterinary medicine school in Nevada would just add on to that level of financial assistance to those in need. Overall, a veterinary medicine school would provide ample opportunity to all students of UNR, I believe, as my previous peer had stated, because it opens job opportunities not only to the people of Kavner and the veterinary science major, but to anyone who might be seeking any form of employment in any of those fields or might want to get a little bit of interest in any of that field. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Hello, my name is Brianna Espana, B-R-I-A-N-N-A. E-S-P-A-N-A. I am a fourth-year veterinary science major at UNR, and I am also an ambassador for the Agriculture, Veterinary, and Rangeland Sciences. I'm here today to strongly support the development of a veterinary school at UNR. As a student pursuing a career in veterinary medicine, I've experienced firsthand how no access to in-state veterinary education impacts Nevada students. Currently, all of us must leave the state to complete our professional education, often at a significantly higher financial cost. Building a veterinary school would create an opportunity for students like me to stay and serve Nevada communities. I love Nevada, and I want nothing more than to practice in Nevada and serve our communities and contribute to the health of our state's animals and agricultural industry. Creating a veterinary school here makes that possible. Thank you.
Thank you. Any more public comment from Reno? None seen. Is there any public comment from the CSN Charleston campus?
Hello, my name is Jim Matovina, M-A-T-O-V-I-N-A. I'm a math professor here at CSN. I would like to encourage you to support item 13, the experimental math program that Dr. Pandy will present today. I can tell you that the pre-calculus co-requisite classes here at CSN, some of the instructors have been frustrated at woefully underprepared students, and they're finding the co-requisite model somewhat insufficient. The creative and innovative program that will be presented by Dr. Pandy is an idea, and we're trying something. We want you to help us support the creativity and the innovation in this program. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Patrick Villa. I'm a math professor here at CSN. I'd like to echo my colleagues' comments and please give full support and consideration to item number 13. Couple things about it. As he mentioned, you know, I've been part of this process for about 15 years in the state trying to find new ways, and we got it changed. As has been stated many times, at the community colleges, it's tough because we have no standard admission requirement to get in. So there are students who are way below what, you know, they are at our counterparts at UNR and UNLV and NSU. And it's them that gets hurt by this. You know, if they want to go to a certain major, they have to take Math 126E. They have to do a six-credit class. And if they fail, and unfortunately a lot of times when they're very underprepared, they will fail, they have no other option except for take the six credits again and again and again, which in my mind defeats kind of the idea of what they were trying to solve initially when the co-recs came out. I think it works well for many students. It's these very low ones that we're hoping to create an option and not waste their time, their money, their semester, and all that. So, again, it's also, in my memory, the first time that we've got Renee in the Vice Chancellor's office kind of giving their blessing to this, for this experimental program, because it's hard to really get a program that fits within the rules of the policy. So it's a first, and as Jim just said, it's an experiment. We're going to pilot it. We're going to try it, and you'll hear a report back. So thank you all so much.
Good morning. My name is Ginger Doe, for the record, last name D-O-E. And I am speaking in personal favor of agenda item 14. As someone who did their pre-veterinary studies at the University of Nevada, Reno, a long time ago, I can say without a doubt that staying in-state for my veterinary degree would have been of significant benefit. I chose to go to Ohio State for veterinary school and loved my time in Columbus, but had I stayed in Nevada, I very likely would have remained in Nevada as a large animal veterinarian with an equine focus. Fond of the alpacas, too, and sheep, so multiple there. So, again, I'm just speaking in favor of agenda item 14, the discussion of the veterinary school at the University of Nevada, Reno. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Good morning, Chair Arascotta and members of the committee. I'm Jennifer McClendon, Chair of the UNR Faculty Senate, for the record. The UNR Faculty Senate has reviewed the proposed change described in agenda item number 9 and has no concerns with the revised royalty distribution formula. The proposal strikes a reasonable balance and aligns with national norms. Faculty can see the value in a proof of concept fund to support early stage research and innovation, and we appreciate the hold harmless provision protecting existing agreements and current faculty. We also appreciate the transparency surrounding this proposal and the multiple opportunities for faculty to engage in dialogue as it moved forward. Regarding agenda item 14, UNR faculty also support the proposed University of Nevada, Reno Veterinary School. It represents an important opportunity to address statewide shortages in veterinary care while supporting Nevada's research capacity, student opportunities, and workforce development. Faculty look forward to contributing their expertise as this proposal continues to develop. Thank you all for your time and your service on this committee.
Good morning, Regents. My name is Carmina Ogbat, A-G-L-U-B-A-T for the record, and I am honored to serve as the student body president at the University of Nevada. I'm also speaking on behalf of agenda item number 14, supporting it. The proposed veterinary program would be the first and only of its kind in Nevada and deserves serious and thoughtful consideration. Right now, many aspiring veterinary students from Nevada are forced to leave our state to pursue their education in places like Utah, California, Oregon, Colorado, and as just mentioned, Ohio State. While they leave with the intention of returning home, the reality is that many of them build their careers where they train. This creates brain drain that Nevada simply cannot afford, especially as our state faces a growing shortage of veterinarians across both urban and rural communities. Creating a veterinary program at the University of Nevada would allow our students to stay in the state they love while pursuing competitive, high-quality education. It would also allow Nevada to invest in its own students, its own workforce, and its own communities. At the university, we deeply believe in the idea that home means Nevada, and that means creating opportunities for students to build their futures right here in the Silver State. By integrating public health and population studies with veterinary education in the classroom, while also providing community and lab-based learning opportunities outside of it, the University of Nevada has the potential to develop a program that not only serves our state, but becomes a leader in veterinary medicine throughout the West. We often talk about growth, whether that is growth in our populations or our buildings, but we should also remember that one of the most important ways we grow as a state is by expanding educational opportunities for our students. We know that this is only one of the first steps in laying out the foundation for a veterinary program, and as you have heard from many other students this morning in public comment, please be ready to hear much more from us as we continue our support for the establishment of a veterinary program in our Silver State. Thank you for your time, and as always, go Pack.
Hello, my name is Carla Martin, K-A-R-L-A-M-A-R-T-I-N.
Matt Carmina, if you could hold off on that, I'd appreciate it. We have not gone to the phones for public comment. SES, please. If we can continue public comment at this CSN Charlton campus, I'd greatly appreciate it.
Good morning. My name is Eric York, Faculty Senate Chair and Math Faculty at Western Nevada College. This morning, I'd like to speak strongly in favor of agenda item number 13, the experimental parachute pilot program for math courses. Math 126, co-requisite supported, is a very challenging course for many students. And this proposal for a pilot program is very much in line with the spirit of the co-requisite program. It is very much in line with the mission of ENCHI in terms of access and student success. And we would strongly support this. Thank you.
Thank you very much. SCS, is there any public comment on the phone?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Caller with the phone number ending in 5293. Please press star 6 to unmute, state and spell your name for the record, and you have 2 minutes to address the committee. Go ahead, caller.
Hello, my name is Carla Martin, K-R-L-A-M-A-R-T-I-N. I'm a second-year student at the University of Nevada, Reno, studying veterinary science and minoring in biology. I'm an agriculture, veterinary, and rangeland science ambassador and an honors college ambassador. I'm here to voice my support in the building of a vet school here in Nevada. In this program, I've met so many students in Nevada with the same passion for saving animals. With only 33 vet schools in the entire country, competition is intense, and that limited number of seats does not match how many future veterinarians are ready to dedicate their lives to animal medicine and forces Nevada students like me to move out of state. Building a veterinary school in Nevada would open life-changing opportunities for Nevadan students, keeping our talent here at home, and creating a clear path from undergraduate study to a DVM without leaving the state. It would also strengthen care across Nevada by training veterinarians who could work in rural communities to the larger cities. A vet school here chooses a better future for students and the state of Nevada. Thank you.
Next caller with a number ending in 8486. Please press star 6 to unmute, state and spell your name for the record, and you have 2 minutes to address the committee.
Hello. Good morning. My name is Dr. James Behnke, B-E-H-N-K-E. I served as the worldwide chief technical officer of the Pillsbury Company in Minneapolis, Minnesota. As Pillsbury's CTO, I had 21 years of experience licensing intellectual property. I currently serve as the treasurer of the Nevada Research and Innovation Corporation. The focus of my comment this morning is to voice strong support for agenda item number 9, the proposed IP royalty and distribution formula, dividing the incoming royalty revenue between three parties: the pool of inventors, 40%, the inventor's academic department, 25%, and the institutional proof of concept fund, 35%. The 40% of the royalty revenues going to the inventors is the median percentage of dozens of R1 universities, including many in the Mountain West Conference. Importantly, the new distribution formula allocates 35% of the royalty revenue to the critical proof of concept fund. This is the space between the initial laboratory creation and the scaled-up invention. Companies are just not willing to accept all the risk involved in licensing an unproven patent. They are looking for at least some scaled-up commercial viability. Without this proof of concept fund, early inventions enter the valley of death. This is where good ideas go to die. I am asking the NSHE Board of Regents to support agenda item number 9, this proposed new allocation of IP royalty revenues. This new formula will prove to be beneficial to the inventors' department, the university at large, and indeed the state of Nevada. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next caller with the phone number ending in 8153. Please press star 6 to unmute. State and spell your name for the record, and you have 2 minutes to address the committee. Caller with the phone number ending in 8153. Go ahead and state and spell your name for the record, and you have 2 minutes to address the committee.
Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Atera Frankel, spelled A-T-E-R-A-F-R-A-N-K-L, and I am a biochemistry student in the College of Agriculture, Biotechnology, and Natural Resources at UNR. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. As a cabinet student, I'm constantly reminded that Nevada's strength lies in its land, its livestock, and its rural community. The health for agricultural systems directly impacts our economy, our food supply, and the stability of community across the state. A veterinary program isn't just an academic expansion, it's infrastructure that supports the entire system. In many rural areas, as Joseph Guild touched on, limited access to veterinary care causes shortages of large animal vets, which creates economic strain and increases risk across agricultural operations. Strengthening that workforce pipeline here in Nevada would mean directly investing in rural sustainability and economic resilience. It would give opportunities to students here in Nevada who are trained to serve Nevada's needs. From a student perspective, this proposal represents opportunity to create clearer in-state pathways for students interested in animal health, agricultural science, and biomedical research. Many research labs on campus, including those working with animal models, rely strongly on veterinary collaborations to ensure ethical standards and animal welfare. Expanding that capacity strengthens not just one college, but interdisciplinary research across the university. As a student who cares deeply about the future of this college and our state, I believe initiatives like this reflect the kind of forward-thinking investment that aligns with Nevada's identity and future. I encourage continued thoughtful planning that keeps students, rural communities, and long-term sustainability at the center of the conversation. Thank you for your time.
And next caller with the phone number ending in 2949. Please press star 6 to unmute, state and spell your name for the record, and you have 2 minutes to address the committee.
Hello, my name is Michael Kagan, K-A-G-A-N, Chair Brooks and Distinguished Regents. I'm the Faculty Senate Vice Chair at UNLV. Our Chair Maria Roberts is unable to attend today. We offer comment with regard to Agenda Item 11. While the goal of expanding access to higher education is commendable, the proposal to reduce the bachelor's degree for some programs from 120 to 90 credits should not move forward without very careful study and consultation. The bachelor's degree has long represented a comprehensive educational experience combining disciplinary depth, critical thinking, and professional preparation. This proposal raises important questions about whether that breadth and rigor can be preserved. This proposal also has significant implications for academic programs. Reducing credit requirements would require restructuring curriculum and could affect accreditation standards. Faculty expertise is essential in determining whether programs can maintain disciplinary standards and learning outcomes with a reduced credit framework. The intended benefits, such as reducing time to degree and lowering educational costs, must be weighed against possible unintended consequences. Students may face challenges transferring credits, meeting graduate school admissions requirements, and competing in professional fields where the traditional 120-credit bachelor's degree remains the norm. Institutions must also consider how a 90-credit model might influence employer perceptions and workforce readiness. For these reasons, we respectfully urge the board to proceed very carefully in order to protect the value and credibility of Nevada's bachelor's degrees. Thank you very much.
That is all the callers we have at this time, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, SCS. I do appreciate it. As we move on to the agenda for academic research and student affairs, I just want to give quick notification that agenda items 8A and 8B are going to be repositioned on today's agenda. Hence, the item 8 will follow agenda item number 4, which is going to be WNC program eliminations. And one more note, if we could. The reference material for 8A is located and referenced in 8B and vice versa. Once again, the reference material in 8A is unintentionally attached to 8B, and from that we're going to be moving on to our consent items. Consent items will be taken together and acted on one motion unless there's an item removed to be considered separately by the committee. Anybody on the committee have any item that needs to be removed to be discussed?
I need items 2B through D. So I can read my disclosure.
Please, Vice Chair Downs.
Pursuant to NRS Chapter 281A, I hereby disclose I'm an employee of WNC and do not have any affiliation with the programs being eliminated because independence of judgment of a reasonable person would not be materially affected in my situation. I will vote on this matter.
Thank you, Vice Chair Downs. Is there a motion on the table for agenda item number 2?
Motion to approve.
So moved. Second.
Thank you, Chair. Excuse me. Thank you, Regent Brown. And approved by Vice Chair Downs. Thank you much. We're going to move on to agenda item number 3.
Chair Arascotta, excuse me, Mr. Counsel. I think we need to take a vote.
Mr. Nielsen, I do appreciate you jumping in on that one. We've had a lot of reverb up here in Reno, a lot of reverb, and the audio that's going on up here is really bad, so I do appreciate you keeping us on point. In regards to agenda item number 2, we heard one motion, both of for approval. Is all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? Thank you very much. Motion passes. We're going to move over to agenda item number 3, which are the 2026 region awards. And pursuant to the body of policy, Title 4, Chapter 1, Section 16 through 20, the committee will consider approval of the following nominations for the 2026 Region Awards. And I will read those here in 1 minute. So these rewards and the recipients of these rewards, we're going to start off from the top. The Sam Lieberman Regents Awards for Student Scholarship. This is, first one's off the top, is going to be UNLV, is going to be Jan Arnaiz from the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, Ulysses Ayers from Western Nevada College, Richard Chang, UNLV, Elena Chow from UNR, Trinity Grants is from Nevada State University, Joseph Warren Ogden from College of Southern Nevada, Casey Scholes, Great Basin College, Wendy Solorio Ramirez is from Chucky Meadows Community College, and Lauren Whiteneck is from the UNR Graduate Program. The Nevada Regents Outstanding Classified Staff Award is going to be going to Melinda Kasky of Great Basin College. The Nevada Regents Award for Creative Activities will be first at Great Basin College at John Patrick Rice, Javon Johnson from University of Nevada, Las Vegas. And apologize here. The Nevada Regents Teaching Award will be for Angela Spears of College Southern Nevada. She's tenured and is tenured track of the community college. Mary Kay Orgill, she is at UNLV, once again tenured and tenured track. And Kelly Kasilica of the University of Nevada, University of Nevada, Reno. Don't want to get those mixed up. And she is non-tenured UNR and DRI. Next, we're going to go to the Nevada Regents Academic Advisory Award, which is going to be for Denishu Moore of College of Southern Nevada, Monica Marino of the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and Jenny Oyang of the University of Nevada, Reno, graduate university and DRI. Nevada Regents Researcher Award will be for Rue Audrey of the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, Audrey Kalistoff of Desert Research Institute, in which is going to be distinguished, and Valerie Friedland, University of Nevada, Humanities and Social Sciences. The Nevada Research Rising Research Award, once again, Nevada Regents Rising Research Award, for Scott Allen at the University of Nevada, Nathan Chelman at DRI. Next will be for Kara Pacella at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and Samantha John, Ed, also from the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Holly Martin of NSU, Sandhya Narayan at the University of Nevada, Katrina Nichols at Nevada State University, Elnez Sailabi at the University of Nevada, and Senji Zayai at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. I want to thank each and every one of these rising researchers and give a strong recognition and compliment and express our appreciation for all that you've involved and all that you continue to infuse into the Nevada system of higher education. So we're going to move over to agenda item number, and that being an action item, is there a motion on the table?
So moved.
Second.
Is there a second? Thank you, Regent Brown, and thank you, Vice Chair Downs. With the motion on the table for approval, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed? Thank you. Motion carries. We are going to be moving on to agenda item number four, which is the program eliminations at Western Nevada College. And this is for a possible action. And if we could get a representative from Western Nevada College, we'd really appreciate it.
Good morning, Chair Escada. This is Dr. Dana Ryan, for the record, Vice President of Academic and Student Affairs at Western Nevada College. Items 4A through 4C, we are requesting approval to eliminate the AAS in accounting, AAS in general business, and AAS in management. These recommendations are a result of our program review, which found that these degrees are terminal, non-transferable programs that no longer align with workforce expectations. Most careers in accounting, business, and management now require at least a bachelor's degree for advancement or certification, making the AAS pathway less effective for long-term student success. In 2017, WNC added an Associate of Business transfer degree. This has consistently had robust enrollment. This degree provides a clear pathway to a bachelor's program. So eliminating these AAS degrees will help reduce duplication and clarify the pathway for students. Currently, we have 98 students actively enrolled across the three AAS degree programs. Students will have 6 years to complete their degree through a teach-out plan, and advising will be working individually with those students who wish to transition into the Associate of Business or a different program. Once approved, the college will close the ability for new students to declare these AAS majors, ensuring that new business students enter the transfer pathway. So with that, we respectfully request approval.
Thank you much. We do appreciate it. The reason for the elimination of these programs, as you stated, are well justified and stated on the top of page 2 of 3 and the reference material. But continuing on the top of page 2, line item B, it states, as you identified, that 61 students have declared Associate of Science in Accounting, 57 with the Associate of Applied Science in General Business, and 64 students have declared the Associate of Science of Management. And once again, is referring to the briefing material, the campus academic staff are willing to work with each student. But my question is, how many academic advising staff members are going to be available for all of these students?
That's a great question. So we total, though, that's 173 students declared, but only 93 enrolled. So in talking with advising, they will be sending out information about this change and offering the opportunity for students to move into the Associate of Business if they'd like. But again, students can continue for 6 years in this pathway and continue to the end of the AAS if they choose. And they will be on standby to help whoever needs assistance in making a different choice.
Okay. Thank you very much. Jeff, do you have any questions for Regent Towns, please?
I'd just like to make a statement pursuant to NRS Chapter 281A. I hereby disclose I'm an employee of WNC and do not have any affiliation with the program as being discussed. Because independence of judgment of a reasonable person would not be materially affected by my situation, I'll vote on this matter.
Are there any questions from the CSN? None heard. Chair Downs, Vice Chair Downs.
I move to approve this request.
I make a second, Regent Del Carlo.
Thank you, Vice Chair Downs and Vice Chair Del Carlo. Excuse me, Regent Del Carlo. Once again, SCS, if we can figure out the reverb, this is brutal up here at the Reno office. Anyhow, thank you all. That's too much on the table for approval. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed? Motion carries. Let's move on to agenda item number 5, the organizational unit proposal from the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Please.
It sounds like there's an open mic in Vegas, and we're getting everything back here.
All good. Well, good morning, Chair Escada, members of the Board of Regents and ARSA committee members, colleagues at ENSHI. I'm Kate Corgan. I am the Acting Executive Vice President and Provost at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. So today I respectfully bring forward two proposals for your consideration and hopefully support. And I'm happy to say that both of them are sort of feel-good proposals that help expand our mission to educate students, create workforce pipelines, expand research, and serve our community. So you may remember that I've been up before you at recent meetings as we've been doing a bit of a cleanup on our campus for centers and institutes. You may recall that we've eliminated some that were no longer active or viable. Well, today I'm here to ask for your support to establish one new center and one new institute. And what's really good about both of these proposals is neither one is starting from scratch. Today, both of these proposals are building on existing faculty, research, student engagement, community outreach that has a proven success record. And so this brings many benefits. The first proposal I'd like to bring forward is the Nevada General Curriculum Access Center. This center would be housed in the Department of Early Childhood, Multilingual, and Special Education in the College of Education here at UNLV. The proposed Nevada General Curriculum Access Center has already been functioning as a dean-approved unit in the College of Education since 2022. Now, it was not functioning as a center. It was functioning as a group of faculty who were writing grants, getting money, doing research, training students, and collaborating closely with the Nevada Department of Education, the Clark County School District, and other community organizations. At the same time, we had other faculty working on similar kinds of work, but these groups weren't brought together under the auspices of a single center. And so today we're asking simply to name these groups and with that, hopefully, achieve a few goals. First of all, by naming them as a center, it brings recognition and ease of marketing so that folks are more aware of what we're doing and how we serve the community. Second, it creates efficiencies, right, by bringing these units together to share resources and collaborate more closely. And third, I think it amplifies the impact of the work that these groups are doing through closer collaboration at the center. Now, this specific center, the Nevada General Access Center, is to support Nevada educators who serve students with extensive support needs. So think students with intellectual disabilities, with autism, those who receive alternative diplomas. And the idea is to create access to the general curriculum for these students and their teachers and families, both throughout K-12 learning environments and then beyond. This work will impact the state's coursework and classrooms in intellectual disability and other developmental disability areas. Now, prior to the creation of the Nevada General Curriculum Access Center, teachers didn't have a centralized location where they could receive direct support that was needed to develop appropriate K-12 curriculum and to support this group of students. So today, I stand before you to ask that we can combine this work under the auspices of a center and continue to expand the reach for students on our campus, for faculty research, and for community impact.
Thank you so much. That was wonderful. We really do appreciate everything that the University of Nevada, Las Vegas is truly providing throughout the Clark County and throughout the Nevada system of higher education. I do have a couple questions. Since the inception of the Nevada General Curriculum Access Center in 2022, how many students have utilized the center?
The reach is broad and wide, and to be honest, I'm not certain on an exact number of students that would be positively impacted because the curriculum goes out across CCSD. We're working with students regionally, but then also the Nevada Department of Education. So I think it would be difficult for me, and I don't want to give you an erroneous number. So I could come back with an estimate if you would like. I would like to say that the impact is pretty broad and wide because we're talking about access for all students who have autism, developmental, and educational disabilities all the way from K through 12.
So definitely. Thank you very much. And as stated also on page 2 of the briefing material, the Nevada Department of Education has budgeted $300,000 a year since 2022, and the Center recently has an additional $747,000 to enhance an online certificate program and intellectual disabilities. Can you expand on those two items, please?
I'm going to ask Dr. Josh Baker, who oversees this program, to talk about the details of the certificate. He's with us here in the room.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. So with the two, the first, the contract, the $300,000, that's for curriculum, professional development support for all of our teachers across the state of Nevada. So it's reaching those teachers that work with this specific population. There's roughly 2,000 to 3,000 students that are on the state's alternate assessment. So it's a very small population, but there's a lack of curriculum and professional development support for that population. Whereas the other grant, we're creating a certificate that's asynchronous in intellectual disability. As this is a very specialized population with specialized training, half of our teachers across the state in those classrooms don't have the proper training. So we are creating that certificate for the state of Nevada. And right now we're piloting the program, and 80% of our teachers are in rural Nevada. So it's not specific to Las Vegas.
Wonderful.
Joshua Baker. Do I need to spell that? Joshuabaker. I'm a professor in the EMS department.
Thank you very much. And while you're up there, let's go ahead and hold on with my last question. Looking at page 6 of 7 under expenditures, my question is, how many employees work at the centers or centers? Do you have a number of cumulative employees?
Well, me, of course, as the director. Then we hire an associate director. We have 4 student workers, and about, don't quote me, but 15 contractors. So we really do have a large, we say we're mean and lean and mean, I guess. Probably 20 people total that we fund, not full-time. Yes.
Thank you so much. More than I originally expected. Regent Downs? Thank you very much. And if you all don't mind standing up there, is there any questions from the committee regarding this agenda item number 5?
Chair Scott, I have a question.
Please go ahead, Regent Del Carlo.
Thank you very much. So this is great. And I think these students certainly deserve this program. And will these students, get a degree? And are they part of the main commencement, or do they have their own separate commencement? How are they treated?
Correct. So within there's multiple aspects to this center. So we would have the professional development for the teachers, but then we also have a post-secondary education program called Project Focus. It's called Pathway to Independence at UNR. And so, yes, they receive a certificate, and we really work towards work employment to their person-centered skills. And they are able to receive a certificate as well as walk across the stage at graduation.
Thank you, Regent Carlo. Great question. Any other questions from the South regarding agenda item 5A? None heard. We're going to continue with you all up on the mic to 5B, which is the Nevada Institute of Cybersecurity at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Please continue.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Our second item, as you note, is the request to support the Nevada Institute for Cybersecurity. As with the last proposal, this is an institute proposal that we bring to you not as a new idea, but as a way to bring together existing activities across our campus, educational and academic programming for students, community outreach, faculty research, into a single interdisciplinary institute across the university. The Nevada Institute for Cybersecurity is, of course, timely. There are a few other academic topics that are more important, I think, to workforce development and the communities that we serve. And so the Nevada Institute for Cybersecurity will be pulling together under the auspices of the Institute a number of existing things, including our UNLV Cyber Clinic, which you may be aware of. The Cyber Clinic is a tremendous service that UNLV faculty and students provide to small businesses in order to support their cybersecurity needs. We have the Nevada Science Foundation CyberCorps Scholarship for Service. We have Gen Cyber Camp, which is a summer camp for youth. We have the Student Augmented Statewide SOC, or Security Operations Center. And all of these are existing activities that would be pulled together under the auspices of the Nevada Institute for Cybersecurity. And so we ask for your consideration and support today.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions from Las Vegas? Excuse me, College of Southern Nevada.
Have a comment?
Please.
Oh, I just think this is great that you're doing this. I mean, cybersecurity is so important to our institution. So thanks for taking the leadership on this one. This is great.
We're very proud of our faculty and students. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm very pleased you're doing this. Thank you.
My one comment would be, if we could follow up with, out of respect for Chair Boylan of the Security Committee, I really think that the same presentation of this information would definitely benefit from Chair Boylan's committee with security at a future item, and I'll definitely mention this to Chair Boylan.
We would appreciate that opportunity. That, yes.
Thank you. But with that stated, we're going to take together action of agenda item number 5A and 5B, the Nevada General Curriculum at Access Center at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, in addition to the Nevada Institute of Cybersecurity, also at the Nevada University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Is there a motion on the table?
Motion to approve.
Thank you, Vice Chair Downs. And I believe that was Regent Brown that jumped in there first. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I was kind of jumping all over the place earlier, and I stated, and I prefaced by giving full notification that agenda item number 8 was going to be jumping up to 5. And so, President Dalby, please accept my apologies and a little bit of a mea culpa. But we will be hearing agenda item number 8 as of right now. Agenda item number 8, if you can come on up to the podium, I'd greatly appreciate it.
All right. Good morning. Dana Ryan, Vice President, Academic and Student Affairs, Western Nevada College. So I'm going to take 8A and 8B together, if that's okay. So these two items work together to update our manufacturing program structure. So item 8A is a requested approval to eliminate the standalone AAS in mechatronics and electronics, and item 8B proposes replacing it with an emphasis in mechatronics and electronics within the AAS in technology degree. This change better aligns the program with our existing AAS technology structure, which already includes other emphases such as construction, machine tool, and welding. By incorporating this pathway as an emphasis within the broader AAS technology degree rather than a standalone, we will maintain the same training opportunities while combining enrollments across the technology pathways, which ensures that the broader technology degree meets minimum completion expectation to avoid being flagged for low yield. We currently have 36 students declared in the existing AAS mechatronics and electronics degree. 5 of those students are enrolled. So as with the other, the AAS is a business. Students have 6 years to complete the degree as it is through the teach-out process. And because the coursework fully aligns, students can transition directly to the new AAS technology, mechatronics, and electronics emphasis, if that's what they prefer. So if approved, the standalone AAS will no longer be available for new students, but existing students will continue through the program, or they can transition over. So for these reasons, we are respectfully requesting approval of both of these items.
You have a question? Okay. Any questions from CSN? None heard. Ms. Ryan, I do have one question. As you stated, you kind of run over a little bit swiftly, but the program elimination and the proposal, what other options will be available for students if they do not want to remain in the program? Because as you just stated, it's going to be somewhat of a warm handoff from one to the other.
Right.
What if they just feel, not for me?
Well, the program won't change for 6 years, so they can finish if they choose to. Or they can switch over. If they don't want to, we will work with them to find something else that they do want. And if it's not just quite for them, we work really closely with our colleague right up the road, TMCC, who their program is a little bit different, but we try to meet students where they are and help them find a path that works for them.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any more questions at all from CSN? None from the dais. Prior to our vote, Regent Downs.
Thank you, Chair. Pursuant to NRS Chapter 281A, I hereby disclose I'm an employee of WNC and do not have any affiliation with these programs being discussed. because the independence of judgment of a reasonable person would not be materially affected by my situation. I'll vote, and I will make the motion that we approve this.
Thank you, Vice Chair Downs. Is there a second?
Second.
Thank you, Regent Brown. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed? Motion carries. Thank you very much, Ms. Ryan. Thank you very much for your patience. You. I do appreciate we got both of these taken care of at one shot. Excellent. So we're going to move over now to agenda item originally number 6, so which is the organization unit proposal at the University of Nevada for the Nevada Forest and Woodland Restoration Institute. And it looks like Provost Thompson is on the podium. Provost Thompson, take it away.
Thank you, Chair Escada and members of the ARSA committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Thompson, and I serve as the Executive Vice President and Provost at the University of Nevada, Reno. I'm bringing forward for your consideration an organizational unit proposal for the Nevada Forest and Woodland Restoration Institute. This is a faculty-led initiative to create an interdisciplinary and cross-sector collaborative program to mitigate wildfire severity and improve ecosystem health. It's a collaboration between our university, state and federal agencies, and tribal and local communities to produce interdisciplinary and actionable forest and woodland science. The intent is to improve forest and woodland health through fire mitigation and restoration efforts. Faculty on the University of Nevada, Reno campus from the College of Agriculture, Biotechnology, and Natural Resources, the College of Science, and our extension offices are all involved in this project. The Institute will be housed at our Little Valley Research Station at the University's 2,650-acre Whittell Forest and Wildlife Area. The creation of this institute will also initiate the university's joining the Southwest Ecological Restoration Institute, which is a consortium of Western institutes funded by the U.S. Forest Service. So I request your support for our proposal, and I'm here to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Provost Thompson. And we're going to start off up here in Reno with a question. Vice Chair Downs.
Thank you, Chair. Provost, I had a question about the housing of this. I thought it was going to be at the Aspen Creek property, but it's going to actually be up at the Little Valley location?
Yes, sir.
So, I mean, are they going to – is there a plan to build structures up there, or what's the – how are they going to have a program based out of – out of that location?
So I misheard your question. Yes, the Aspen Creek property, which we consider part of the Little Valley property also, it's our access point to the Little Valley property.
Okay, so is that the Aspen Creek's where it's going to be? Okay. That's what I thought when you said it's going to be up at the Little Valley. I consider that as – I know that that's the gateway to it, but it is a separate thing. Okay, thank you. Thank you for the clarification.
Thank you.
Questions from the dais?
I just have a comment, Regent Arascata, or Chair Arascata.
Please.
I really appreciate this one, too, Provost Thompson, living in the forest like I do and being subject to wildfires seasonally. It's a scary thing, and I go back 5 years when we had that horrible fire and our air quality in Incline Village was over 700. And healthy air is under 50. You can't do enough for me to mitigate these tragedies from occurring. So I really appreciate the effort that you're doing and the research you'll do for this, because I do know that where I live in Incline Village, our North Lake Tahoe Fire District does a very good job of clear cutting and making sure the undergrowth is cleared out, and that's not what happened on the fire to the south in California, because they don't have the same, they're more tree huggers is the word, but you got to clean the forest or it's going to take care of itself, and that's when we get those huge forest fires. So thank you for this.
Thank you, Regent Del Carlo, and this is an issue for our entire state and something that we have to be proactive on as a state to support our communities.
Thank you. And Regent Del Carlo, you are the voice of experience up there in the wooded areas of Incline, so thank you.
Yes, I'd like to make the motion if there's no other questions.
I do have one question, Regent Carlo.
Okay.
All right. Provost Thompson, as the briefing paper stated on Section C, subsection E, in the last paragraph of page 5 of 9, the Little Valley Research Station located in the Whittell Forest will be the physical home of the Nevada Forest and Woodland Restoration Institute, as stated by Chair Downs, Vice Chair Downs. Is this location, this one that's well tucked up into the mountain ranges, is it accessible for students of or employees to come up and take a look at this new institute?
So thank you, Regent Downs. To your question, Regent Arascata. To Regent Downs' question, the Aspen Creek facility is fully accessible with paved roads. It is more difficult to get into Little Valley. We do have the vehicles and the ability to transport people to that area to do the work. We'll be able to, as we do now, bring in visitors and make sure they understand the research that we'll be doing there and the value of that property for our state and for our programming.
Wonderful to hear. Thank you very much. Any other questions to the dais? Let's move on. May I introduce a motion on the table for the establishment of the Nevada Forest and Woodland Restoration Institute focused on Nevada on the restoration of forests and woodlands. Is there a motion on the table?
I make the motion. This is Regent Del Carlo.
Thank you, Regent Del Carlo.
I'll second the motion.
Thank you, Vice Chair Downs. Any other comments, questions? All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? None stated. Thank you, Provost Thompson. Do appreciate your time.
I have a quick request from Provost Thompson that perhaps for the June meeting, if Regents could be given the opportunity to go visit both the Aspen Creek Station and the Whittell Forest, that might be nice to see. I know the extent of the offer in the past, but you know, not everyone is able to take you up on that offer. But it would be nice if that were to be available again in the future.
We will make sure it's available. Thank you, Regent Downs.
I like that. Thank you both. We're going to move over to the original agenda item number 7, which is going to be the program proposal for the construction management of the Associate of Applied Science at Truckee Meadows Community College. And on the podium is TMCC. Please go ahead.
Thank you and good morning, Chair Arascata. For the record, Dr. Melissa Dedman, Interim Vice President of Academic Affairs at Truckee Meadows Community College. And we are bringing forward, as you mentioned, an Associate of Applied Science in Construction Management for your consideration. The degree is designed to provide students with foundational skills in construction methods, blueprint reading, cost estimating, scheduling, and job site safety towards the planning and coordination of construction projects. And this proposal represents the final step in separating the former AAS in architecture and construction into two programs. The AAS in architectural design, which this body approved in December 2025, and the currently proposed AAS in construction management. The separation was recommended by our Construction Management Advisory Board in spring 2025 to allow each program to focus more clearly on its own curricular pathway and industry needs. Labor market data strongly supports this program. The Occupational Information Network identifies construction management as a bright outlook career, meaning employment is expected to grow faster than average nationwide between 2024 and 2034. And in the Reno area in particular, projected growth is about 18% between the years 2022 and 32, with a median annual salary exceeding $106,000. Similarly, the Nevada Department of Employment Training and Rehabilitation projects a 17.5% employment growth, with approximately 555 annual openings during the same period. The proposed curriculum was intentionally aligned with Western Nevada College's BAS in construction management. This creates a clear pathway for students who wish to continue to a bachelor's degree. And as Dr. Ryan mentioned, we deeply appreciate the positive collaboration between TMCC and WNC, including the faculty and myself with Dr. Ryan. Using the spring 2025 construction course enrollment data, which was the most recent we had at the original time of the proposal, we are projecting an initial headcount of 68 students with modest 2% increases in years 3 and 5. And although the course sequence reflects a full-time schedule in your information packet, we know that at TMCC about 73% of our students attend part-time, and so we factored that into our calculation of full-time enrollments during the 1, 3, and 5-year period. TMCC is committed to the success of this program. We recently hired a full-time instructor, the first in many years of it not having one. And in closing, we are excited to bring forward a program supported by our advisory board, aligned with a growing workforce need in Northern Nevada. And with that, I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you so much, Dr. Dedman. Well done. Are there any questions from CSN?
Chair?
Or, please.
Thank you so much. Regent Brown for the record. I just want to say that academically, construction is often, in the engineering space, is often treated like the redheaded stepchild. And we all know that that's not only growing sector, but I also love to see that homegrown talent is being cultivated at the community college level as well. I just attended a big competition. Some of the UNLV students from the construction management or the construction engineering vertical were up in the north at a competition, and every single one of those students received job offers at the competition. Some of the groups came in second place. Like, it was a really cool opportunity. I love seeing it. And, you know, the reason why a lot of you had a hard time getting government rates and had to stay further out is because the big construction conference is here in town. So we know the sector is growing. And so I just wanted to say that I think it's really great to see that you guys are starting out with a stronger foundation at TMCC.
Thank you, Regent Brown. We're certainly keeping abreast of the trends as well. And it's timely that we're bringing forward this proposal.
So well stated. Thank you, Regent Brown.
I just have a comment.
I do have. Oops. Oh, please go right ahead, Regent Dalcarlo.
It's so hard just to know what. Do you want us to text you or just do what we're doing to get your attention?
Let's just do what we're doing. Right, okay. After the discussion, we'll just go right down to you all.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Arascotta. I just want to say I love the collaboration between you and your sister institution, and we are so stronger together. It's much better when we can collaborate and help each other. So,
yes. Yeah. Thank you, Regent Dalcarlo. I agree wholeheartedly. In fact, there was a comment in today's an article in today's Chronicle of Education, Higher Education, essentially speaking to that system-wide we need to, you know, be re-embracing more collaboration. And again, it's been a pleasure working with Dr. Ryan on this and other projects.
Great. Glad. Happy to hear that. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I do have a few questions also. With the proposed semester implementation of fall of 2026, my questions are regarding the instructional delivery. It's stated on page 7 under section F and section G. Is a less than 50% online offering, is that a complement to the projected first semester headcount of 68 students?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question, please, sir?
Sure can. Right there on page 7, under section F and G, it says that less than the 50% online offering, it's a complement. Is it a complement to the projected first-year headcount of 68 students?
Thank you, sir. Again, Melissa Dedman for the record. I understand the question now. The 50% online really speaks to the delivery modality of the courses, not to the headcount per se. So the headcount we're projecting is irrespective of the delivery mode.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Dedman. And one more, if you can look at the reference material. On page 11 of 17, under section 2, revenue, under revenue, number 5 describes other student fees. And under, I was looking at our P&G manual, which is chapter 7, section 10 of our P&G manual. There's not a differential fee currently applied to any program of this type. So is this a proposed differential fee for the future, or where is this coming from?
No, thank you, sir. It is not a proposed differential fee. Most likely it reflects a portion of some of our online offerings and tech fees associated with that.
Because of the online presence?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it, Dr. Dedman. Any other comments, questions, discussion? None stated? And this is, where am I? This is a possible action item. Is there a motion on the table?
Motion to approve. Second.
Thank you. Thank you, Regent Brown and Del Carlo. Any other discussion? None stated. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? None opposed. Motion carries. Thank you, TMCC and Dr. Dedman. Well done. As we already moved up agenda item number 8, to piggyback onto 4, we're going to jump over to agenda item number 9. And agenda item number 9 is the intellectual properties. So Associate Vice Chancellor for Academic and Student Affairs, Renee Davis, will present information and discussion and have discussions regarding these revisions regarding board policy. Ms. Davis, please continue.
Good morning. Renee Davis, Acting Vice Chancellor for Academic and Student Affairs. Thank you for the chance to come talk to you today about this proposal. Today we're bringing forward for your information a revision to Title IV, Chapter 12, Sections 2 and 8 of the Handbook. We're bringing this as an information item so that there is further opportunity for revision should it be necessary prior to requesting your approval. This revision comes forward at the request of the Research Affairs Council and would bring NG's intellectual property policy into alignment with national norms for income distribution. Members of the RAC are present here in Las Vegas should there be questions. Simply stated, this policy revision seeks to update the model of intellectual property income distribution. The current policy distribution is 60% to the personnel who develop the intellectual property, 25% to the personnel's academic unit or department, and 15% to the institution. The proposed revision would change this distribution to 40% to the personnel who develop the intellectual property, 25% to the person's academic unit or department, 15% to the institution's central fund, and 20% to a proof of concept fund. Language in this revision also includes definitions for institutional central fund and institutional proof of concept fund. Notably, the institutional proof of concept fund is defined as a special fund or account established and managed by the institution to support projects that aim to demonstrate the viability and potential value of early stage innovations or inventions developed within or on behalf of the institution. This fund is typically used to provide resources for prototype development, initial testing, or validation activities necessary to advance a concept closer to commercialization or practical application. Thank you for your attention. The RAC members and I stand ready to answer any questions.
Thank you so much, Ms. Davis. Are there any questions from College Southern Nevada?
Yes, Chair.
Please, Regent Brown.
Thank you. Regent Brown, for the record. So this had been, I'm 3 years on the board now, so I want to say 2.5 years ago is when I actually first brought this up as something I wanted to have a conversation about. And I've met with several people that are sitting in the audience about this. And, you know, I really do want to help grow our commercialization. You know, I was actually part of a GoEd-funded study that talked about why addressing tech transfer would actually be beneficial to expanding and boosting entrepreneurship in the state. So I think having this conversation not only will be beneficial for many reasons internally, but it's also beneficial to the state's trajectory. I do think that accelerating commercialization develops not only innovation, but also provides early stage funding through the SBIR and STTR, different grants, and then it even fosters a public-private partnership. My concern with this is that the distribution fails to address a unified proposal that can grow our commercialization at a system level. I understand that the general range for distribution for the researcher is 30 to 50% of net revenue, but we're proposing something right down the middle without considering a TTO, which is a technology transfer office, that would be a hub for all three universities. Now, I understand that, you know, every institution is doing amazing things. I do think that our goals should be reducing costs, avoiding triplication of spending and speed up decision making and reducing silos. I had met with our folks at all the institutions, and I said that I personally was not comfortable with the 40% for the researcher, because currently researchers will get paid through licensure share revenue if it actually commercializes, equity from a startup company if the deal is presented correctly, and they can even get sponsored research funding. Plus, they're getting their paychecks as professors and researchers on campus, and then I think most of the time the institutions are funding the bill for the IP applications and stuff. And so I'm glad this is for information only, because I do think that we should look at this holistically and where we actually want to go. I was given an example where one researcher was given 30% of their institution and they later came back and gave them more. That is something we can always do, but it will be hard to take away. So I don't know why we would start higher and not give that opportunity and for the institutions to also negotiate with each researcher. So thank you.
Thank you, Regent Brown.
Thank you, Regent Brown. Any other questions or comments from the South?
Regent Iris Scott, I have a question.
So okay, go right ahead, Regent.
Were the numbers pulled from somebody in public comment said it was the national standards or something? Media. So is that where the numbers, who came up with this breakdown?
So the proposal originated from RAC, and we do have some members here, but I can confirm that the research that we also did in the system office indicates it's kind of the middle of the road, and so we consider this aligning with the norm.
I'd love to chime in, because, yes, it is right down the middle of what an average is. But is it the average of the institutions that we want to be, or the average of all the institutions? And I don't think that starting at 40 is necessarily a hard line. And quite frankly, starting at 35 for the researcher is actually just giving 5% back to this over TTO office, and it helps the institutions navigate with more money. So it's, I actually don't understand. I mean, I'm glad this isn't for possible action, because, you know, I want to have this conversation. I'd like to see, of the institutions that we want to be, you know, where do we fall in that? And look, I've had hours-long conversation offline about this. So this is not something new. Like I said, I brought it up 2.5 years ago. I am disappointed it got to this point where it got published without actually having a broader conversation. I understand they're having them on campus, and I commend all the work. And I know we're going from 60 to 40, but 60 is insane. It just is. And I understand why we started there. But I want to build something that that moves forward that is actually beneficial to all of our institutions and where we want to go and commercializing, because I think it'd be really great. I don't think a single president from these research institutions would be upset with actually commercializing the IP that they've paid for, so then they could throw it back into. And I love the idea of a proof of concept fund. That's amazing. But we also, the whole reason why, you know, we're doing this distribution percentages is because we want to give the institutions money. We want to incentivize department chairs for, you know, pushing and allowing for better and more research. And there is a way to calculate this that I think is actually more beneficial to our system, which is my job sitting here, is to care about the system and what we're doing and how we actually will use this money to further our missions. I love that we have two R1 institutions and a standalone research institution, but it actually doesn't mean that much if we're not taking that money and commercializing it to rebuild. It's like we have to take the money and put it back in and grow it. And I just think that these numbers should be different. Thank you.
Thank you, Regent Brown. And Vice Chair Downs, any questions, comments?
Thank you, Chair Arscotta. So I guess I'm feel like I'm being educated by this whole process. It was when I first learned it was a 60% to go to 40%, and I mean to see we talked to I forget what the leader is called of the for the research area, the research council, whatever. Yeah, and you know it's very informative, and I do want to say I appreciate Regent Brown's perspective on this, especially in her work in the what we're going to call it, the entrepreneurial space, and that's just something that probably I wouldn't say a blind spot, just not a strength I have. So it's nice to hear other perspectives on how this should go or could go, and I'm glad this is an information item so we can still develop this idea. I do appreciate that we have the support of Faculty Senate from UNR about this. I was hoping to hear more from other faculty senates and other faculty who would be affected by this. I'm curious what DRI would say or UNLV would say, but some more input would be good. Thank you.
Oh, that red carpet's about to be laid out right now, Chair Downs. So a couple questions I want to bring out. Ms. Davis, thank you. And over your left shoulder, Ms. Davis, I do see Dr. Gotham from the University of Nevada, Reno, just chomping at the bit back there. But I feel it's important to draw the attention to the last paragraph of the first page of the reference material. And here, it clearly states the impetus and identifies the support for this board policy. It says that it's vetted thoroughly with the business officers, the faculty senates at each research institute, the faculty senate chairs across ENSHE, and across an academic affairs council without formal objections or proposed edits. So as Chair Downs just mentioned, if we could hear from representatives of each of the institutes of research, I'd appreciate it. And Dr. Gotham, I see you over there tapping away. So do you mind coming up to the podium and voicing a couple questions or receiving a couple questions or even making a statement? Introduce yourselves first, last name, and spell, please.
Myrtle Gautam, M-R-I-D-U-L, Gautam, G-A-U-T-A-M. I'm the Senior Vice President for Research and Innovation at the University of Nevada, Reno. Here to answer any questions.
Dr. Gautam, a couple questions in regards to the campus support, the origination of this idea, and hearing about the 40-20 35, I'm losing the numbers on the split, 40-40-20s, but mostly on the 40% as brought up by Regent Brown and the proposal to potentially have it reduced down to 35. Would that be detrimental to the campus, or is the 40% uniformity with the other Western states and through the country?
Well, I'll give you the genesis of this. You know what the dominant percentage is right now? 60% to the inventor, 25% to the departments, and 15% to the university. The universities do spend a significant amount of work in moving our research findings to for public good. At the end of the day, this is all about public good. You take your research, convert that into products, and move forward. We were a bit of an outlier, and several years ago, we thought 60% would spur more commercialization. Well, it has, maybe it hasn't. So we looked at the at about 50 universities, universities like ours, land grant, R1 institutions, and there were some other non-land grant as well. I'm leaving the Yales of the world and Stanfords out of this and University of Washington out of this, who give 27-30% to the inventor. And this is all with the net. You get the gross, take out the expenses, and then you divide it up based on the net. We looked at 40, 50%, 33% across the board. We found that the median amongst institutions like ourselves was 40%. Should have been 45, should have been 35, that's a range. It really doesn't matter. But this was a two-year discussion with the faculty and students, and I think this is across the board. I have tremendous respect for Regent Brown. She and I have had lots of discussions, and we talked about this, you know, over the years, and she's very supportive of this. So from the system perspective, 35 is great. From a conversation as where we were at 60, coming down to 40, could we come down to 35? That's where we believe from our perspective, and we will do whatever the regents you all decide. It's your decision, your vote. We thought having our discussions with the faculty of 40% was a defensible equilibrium. 35, 33% would be below the median. 60% down to 40% was already a major concession that our faculty and everybody else gave. So this was really about a trust that was developed with the faculty and staff also, by the way. Everything is open to the staff and the faculty across all institutions. So this is where the 40% came from, the fact that it was a median, and there were discussions that went on. And we passed the information to the NC leadership.
Thank you, Dr. Gautam. We're going to listen to your peers from the other two research institutes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Gautam.
So I'm Dave Hatchett, H-A-T-C-H-E-T-T. I don't have anything to add. I agree. Everything Myrtle said, we are in agreement with. The only thing I would add is there's a balance that we tried to achieve, and that is balancing faculty wanting to move their research to, you know, the real world versus a reduction of the royalties that they would get. So I would say, as someone who has patents, who works with corporations right now, a lot of faculty don't want to be business owners. They don't want to be. What they want to do is do their research. This is a balance where they can still do their research, and there is now funds available to translate that research to the real world. The balance is the incentive for them to continue to do it. If you keep reducing the royalties associated with the research they do, they may decide not to do that. So I think there is a balance here.
Thank you, Mr. Hatchett, or Dr. Hatchett, excuse me.
For the record, Vic Etemezian, E-T-Y-E-M-E-Z-I-A-N, Vice President for Research at DRI. I don't have too much to add to what Dr. Hatchett and Gautam said, except to kind of address Regents Down's inquiry. We did at DRI, and I believe at the other institutions as well, alert our faculty senates that this was an item that was coming up for discussion. At DRI, certainly, there was no objection to the proposed reduction from the 60% value, and there was support for bringing this up, and there was understanding that the provision of additional resources for a proof-of-concept fund would be extremely valuable for the kinds of commercializations that we have going on.
Thank you, Dr. Etemezian. Any other questions? Oh, Ms. Davis is walking back up. Thank you very much. Well, I just want to point that this agenda item regarding intellectual properties will unquestionably be readdressed well before our next quarterly meeting, as it brings line to the national norm, but most likely this will be brought up again during a special meeting. What I'm looking at dates are going to be somewhere in April. So if the three individuals who are just at the podium, please take note, this will be readdressed at a special meeting for academic research and student affairs, most likely in April. I do appreciate your input, and especially the input of the Regents of the South, Vice Chair Downs, and Ms. Davis. Thank you very much. Appreciate
it. Chair, I'm so sorry. I just would like to make one more comment, if that's okay.
Yeah, please go right ahead, Regent Brown.
Thank you. I do want to kind of highlight some of the stuff that was just said. You know, when we started the 60%, and to Regent Downs' point, maybe a little more background, not in this meeting, but a little bit more background would be helpful with the origins. But 60% did not necessarily spur more research. And so when I'm looking at these new numbers, 60% of zero is a lot less than 35% or 40% of something. And spending this extra percentage to, you know, with the fund and giving it to the institutions to reinvest, I think for me the idea that somebody's going to take their research into the real world, I mean, you're balancing between research and teaching, and so you'll be given more teaching opportunities, which means less time for your research. The number I'm sitting on, 5% is not going to change someone's mind to not bring their research here, and I find that statement to be kind of silly. And also, if they don't want to house it within the institution, then they'll lose access to our labs, they'll lose access to all of the structures that we provide. So I also find that to be silly. And then, like I said, if they're going to be teaching more, it's less time for their research. And I agree, not every professor and not every researcher is going to be a CEO of their company. That is true. And that is why we have entrepreneurs that are scaling and growing and need this technology, which is exactly why we have to do this, so we can actually commercialize and make money off of this piece of the institution, the piece that we are so proud of, the thing that we talk about a lot. So again, I'm glad it's not up for possible action, because I just don't find those arguments to be strong, and I'm happy to have this conversation over and over and over until we can actually figure out what we want to do with the system moving forward. So thank you, Chair, for the leeway.
My pleasure, Regent Brown. As previously stated, agenda item number 9 is for information only, and thank you everybody for their input today. We're going to transition quickly over to agenda item number 10, which is the handbook revision of INSHE policy on instructional material. And today it's going to be presented by Director of Policy, Tarina Concerto. Tarina, this is all yours.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair, Vice Chair, Committee members. Director of Policy, Tarina Concerto. Today I bring for your consideration of approval a handbook revision to INSHE policy on instructional materials, Title IV, Chapter 14, Section 29. So prior to walking you through the revisions, I'm going to provide a bit of background and context. Existing board policy for the faculty selection of instructional material, Title IV, Chapter 14, Section 29, in general, the section of the handbook, this section provides for faculty to determine what instructional materials are most appropriate for the learning objectives of their course. Selection of instructional materials involve many criteria. They must be current, they must be relevant, appropriate for the focus of the course, and should be sought specifically to accomplish the educational objectives of the course. Additionally, faculty also consider cost, ease of access, and where appropriate, develop free or low-cost options, as the policy already indicates. So to this end, institutions have been working towards the use of open educational resources and low-cost and no-cost options for some time across the system, within the institution, in some cases between institutions like the community colleges as a group. So the term that I just used, open educational resources, refer to the teaching, learning, and research materials of any format and medium that reside in the public domain or are under copyright or intellectual property that have been released under open license that permit no cost access for reuse, repurpose, adaptation, and redistribution with no or limited restriction. So the use of open educational resources and no-cost and low-cost options underscore the effort to increase affordability and access to instructional materials for our students. So all of this I've just discussed is to provide you some context. So here we are today, and why we are here today is during the 2025 legislative session, Assembly Bill 345 was passed, and this bill was introduced by Assemblywoman Erica Mosca. AB 345 requires the Nevada System of Higher Education to create definitions to be used system-wide of OER and no-cost and low-cost instructional material. AB 345 also requires the institutions to identify courses that meet the definition of low-cost and no-cost materials to be designated and those options marked prominently in the course schedule. So last fall, we assembled a team of subject matter experts in this area from across the system, from each institution, to work on these definitions. The group consisted of library leaders, instructional design, and material experts. We studied the best practices across our system already that have been established, and national standards and trends, and the group worked on the policy language that you see before you today. Three of those working group members are here today to provide additional information should you need it. We have Paula Miktovich, the instructional designer and co-chair of the CSN OER Steering Committee. We have Dr. Maggie Farrell from the Dean of Libraries at UNLV, and here with us in the south and in the north, we have Dr. Catherine Cardwell, Dean of the University Libraries at UNR. So as a result of the larger working group, we now have what's before you is proposed the unified and aligned definitions of OER, no-cost, and low-cost options. So I'll walk you quickly through the document itself. So we reformatted this section. You'll see it looks a little bit different from what it currently is, only because it was just paragraphs long. So we reformatted the section into subsections just for ease of consumption of information. And then we did not remove any substantive language that was already there. And then to comply with AB 345, we added into Section 2 language that each course that exclusively uses no-cost or low-cost educational materials shall be identified in the course registration system. And then Section 3, we have the definitions as required by AB 345. We have cost as the consistent total purchase price for the faculty preferred format of all required instructional material for a single course. No cost means the list price of zero, and then low cost meaning the total list price of greater than zero, but no more than 40. And then at the very end, you'll see that we placed formal definitions of open educational resources, instructional material, and library license material. Again, I have the subject matter experts handy should you have specific questions of the work they do in this space. But I am here to request approval of the proposed handbook revision to bring us into alignment with AB 345, which goes into effect July 1, 2026. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Caserta. Let's keep those expert agenda, those experts on cue, just in case they do receive any questions. Vice Chair Jones, questions?
I don't have any questions. I think this is it's already a practice. I believe that's going on in many schools, just to allow students to know what to expect when they get their textbook. Mm-hmm. So if it's going to be an OER, low cost, or regular. And this doesn't require anyone to use any specific type of book. It maintains academic freedom. It just allows students to have a better understanding of what they can expect when they enroll in a course.
Comments? Let's go down to the dais at CSN, please.
Question? This is Regent Del Carlo.
Please.
Tarina, did we look at which percentages of use at the campuses? I mean, do we have any statistics on, like, who's the best, you know, who's using the most OER? Because I think that should really be a goal of this whole board, to really promote it. I mean, if we really care about access, we all hated raising tuition. I mean, it just broke everyone's heart. We had to do it. But, I mean, I know we're going to probably at some point look at our strategic plan again, but I really think that we should develop a goal for this board to go towards this. Now, I totally support academic freedom, totally, totally. But I really think the overall cost of going to school is never going to go down, okay? It's going to always be going up. And anything we can do to help our students, and this is a wonderful way to help students, and I do believe we have an institution that's done quite a lot. I mean, I'd really love to hear from some presidents if they're in the room. And maybe like even a percentage of what they're doing. Thank you.
Regent Del Carlo, I think you're teeing up President Dalpy there. Please, President Dalpy.
Thank you, Chair. Kyle Dalpy, Western Nevada College, for the record. So I have some numbers from Western Nevada College that I can share. And since you opened the opportunity, Regent Del Carlo, I'll throw it out there. We are one of the two smaller institutions, so I can only imagine that it scales up from here. In the fall of 25 and this current semester, spring of 26, about one-third of all of our course sections are using some form of OER, and that is saving students approximately $555,000 a year. And I want to note, too, that when we started looking at this way back, the idea was to cost savings, but there is also an academic piece in which students who can't maybe get the books until some financial aid comes through, or maybe they're on order and they can't quite get them before the classes start, oftentimes the OERs are available even before the classes start so that they can start prepping on material, which is a success measure. And so there's a whole lot there, and I would encourage this to be part of, if we're going to talk about it and continue to move forward, part of our strategic plan system-wide. Thank you.
Thank you for that validation. I agree.
Dr. Dalpy, we're going to go to your left, President Dinelli, if you up there at one of the smaller campuses also regarding OER.
Thank you for the record, President Dinelli, Great Basin College. Chair Arascotta, I would say that we're one of the institutions that this was fairly new to. We had some transition in our library, but we have a team that is fully engaged in the process with the system, and we are currently working this through all of our faculty, looking at classes, and so we're happy to be a part of it. We're happy that it is taking into account all of the institutions, and so it's easier for us to be picked up into that. We're being shared what's effective, what's working, what some of the roadblocks are, and why some faculty might not want to add some of these opportunities into their classes. And so we just appreciate the shared services and information. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you, President Dinelli. We're going to I see you jumping on there, President Hebe. I'm going to pump the brakes on you, but we're going to go over to the colleges first. We're going to go over to President Alexander at Truckee Meadows Community College.
Thank you very much, Chair Arascotta. Jeffrey Alexander from Truckee Meadows Community College, for the record. At TMCC, we have prioritized OER content for several years now, beginning in 2021 when we launched a program to help fund faculty research in this space to give them the time and the resources necessary to develop OER content for their classes on a voluntary basis, and many, many of them jumped in. We had probably over 100 faculty take part over a three-year period, and we surpassed 400 core sections a couple of years ago. We're probably closer to 600 core sections now. And we anticipate and estimate that by 2023-24, we were saving students probably about $1 million a year, certainly north of $900,000. The further we get from the point at which a textbook was used and students paid for a textbook in a given class, the more years pass since that time when we use OER, the savings dollar amount becomes something of a hypothetical because it is counterfactual. We're no longer using a book. We don't know what they would have chosen if they chose to use a textbook and bill students for that. But the estimate, I think, is still fair, and certainly we are increasing the number of core sections every year. And now we have an OER Commons library where faculty can access digital content and access new OER sources so we don't have to reinvent that wheel. Faculty and their colleagues and their new colleagues can jump in and access OER content as needed, and this helps to keep the wheel turning. And then finally, the OER content that we're using now really is invaluable for not only our instructors but elsewhere. This is an OER Commons hub that is international, and they can access material from elsewhere, and TMCC can also be a resource for other institutions. Thank you.
Thank you, President Alexander. President Klippenstein?
Yes, Chair Arascotta, this is Stacey Klippenstein, proud president of CSN. For the record, similar to TMCC, we have been engaging in OER for a number of years. It's been a faculty-led process. At this given time, I could not tell you the total amount saved of our students, but with the amount of our OER, I would imagine we're probably over $1 million in the savings in regards to that, but we have been actively engaged in this process over the last definitely 3 to 4 years. But I'd be happy to provide more details. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We're going to go to your left. I believe you have Acting President Amber Lopez Lassiter. No? Okay. We're going to go to UNLV President Heavey, Interim President Heavey.
Thank you, Chair Arascotta. Chris Heavey, Interim President of UNLV, for the record. We've been working in the OER space for quite a few years, and I want to really commend our Dean of Libraries, Dr. Maggie Farrell, who's been an active participant on this committee. This initiative will help us track more closely the number of courses that have adopted OERs. And I want to say that to support open educational resources, you really need to provide faculty a lot of help to develop them, to keep them up to date. And so it's not a no-cost initiative because the institution really needs to put in a lot of kind of groundwork and scaffolding to make sure that the OERs are available and up to date and maintained. And so the library and online ed have partnered to create those opportunities for faculty to develop these, and it definitely has led to very substantial, we don't have an exact number either, but definitely north of $1 million in savings to students. Thank you. So we fully support this initiative and appreciate the system helping us track these more closely.
Wow, that was a big number. Thank you. And at the University of Nevada, President Sandoval.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Brian Sandoval, President of the University of Nevada in Reno. I know we have Dean Cardwell in the room with all of you. This has been a priority of hers since her arrival on campus, and I'm sure there was efforts that before that. But we've been very pleased with the results, and it's been very complimentary to our Digital Wolfpack initiative, which is the initiative whereby all of our students receive an iPad Air. And so I'm going to, with your permission, Mr. Chair, I'm going to defer to Dean Cardwell because she'll have the specific information that you're seeking. Thank you.
Yep. Dean Cardwell.
Good morning. Thank you. I do have some information to share with you. We have been active in this space for quite some time thanks to some support from Provost Thompson. He has funded over the past several years a workshop series and faculty learning community to implement OER into courses. We too have, we've probably worked with about 50 faculty from across the campus, and it's growing every year, so we're building the infrastructure for it, and I think I would say, too, that we have we probably save students more than $1 million a year. And I do believe going forward in this next year, we have faculty lined up in core writing, several large gen ed courses, common core courses, so that we have broader impact. It will also impact the dual enrollment students. So we save them and their school districts money. They won't have to buy materials for those core writing courses. In addition to working directly with faculty, we did work with the registrar's office last year to implement a course marking system that we piloted last year, and that's in place. I took a look at it this morning, and I saw a lot of people who weren't part of the OER workshop. So it's out there. People are using it, and we're going to see it. Now that these courses are going to be marked, it's going to be easier for us to identify them as well. We've also partnered with a company called Scylla, which allows faculty to search on their own for open educational resources. They can take a look at their syllabus, can take a look at their learning outcomes, and faculty can identify OER that could complement their courses. And so it also integrates into Canvas, which makes it more impactful for our students. I do want to highlight an event that is happening tomorrow that a lot of your faculty are participating in. It's a statewide OER symposium online, and people can attend and learn more about changing their pedagogy, promoting OER, and moving it into their courses. So any further questions? And I really appreciate the university support for this. As President Heavey mentioned, OERs aren't free. We do a lot of work behind the scenes to make this happen for students, but we believe in access, and we believe in, you know, making sure that we're providing that access to all students, no matter what institution they're at.
Thank you. Thank you very much. What just was on display was strong uniformity from the executive leadership throughout the Nevada system of higher education. Why we are here was just stated. Mm-hmm. We're here for students. We're here to get them opportunities for education. Right. Thank you all. Really do appreciate it. And this was and is for possible action.
Rascada, so we have another comment from Ginger Doe, please.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Chair Arascada, if I may turn it over to the NSU Faculty Senate Chair, Buwali, who has some information from their library regarding their OER project.
Please continue.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak. So I got some information from our university libraries, and I'm the Academic Faculty Senate Chair, Buwali, for the record. So according to our librarians, and all the credit goes to them and the full and part-time faculty who participate in this, the NSU no-cost textbook initiatives have saved an estimated $1.5 million since 2017. They have a summer institute that they run, and about 40% of all full-time faculty have participated. And then very quickly, the impact from the data that they collected comparing the faculty who use or transitioned from textbooks to OERs. The data indicates that 14% more students received a grade of B- or better in sections with a no-cost textbook, and there was a 50% reduction in grades of D-F withdrawal in the sections where students were not required to purchase a textbook. So good impacts all around. Thank you.
Wonderful. This is great. I want to appreciate it very much, Mr. Buwali. Any other questions? And thank you, Regent Del Carlo, for jumping in on that one. Anything else coming from College of Southern Nevada? None stated. As this being a possible action, I'm going to introduce a motion on the table.
I'll make the motion, Chair Scotta, for approval for a revision to Board Policy Title 4, Chapter 14, Section 29, concerning instructional materials.
I'll second that.
Thank you, Regent Del Carlo with the first, Regent Brown with the second. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed? Motion carries. Thank you all very much. I really appreciate the obvious collaboration between each campus, faculty, staff. We're here for one reason, students. Thank you for everybody. I really, really appreciate that presentation. Next is going to be an information item on agenda number 11, which is the Time to Degree Innovation in Baccalaureate Programs. The Associate Vice Chancellor of Academic Student Affairs, Renee Davis, will present this information. Ms. Davis, please continue.
Thank you, Chair Escada. Renee Davis, for the record. This presentation before you is going to be a very timely and important conversation for the whole system and a discussion the board needs to have with the campuses. So we're going to go ahead and get started here. What we're talking about today is the reduced credit hour baccalaureate degree. And there is lots of talk out there in the national climate with accreditors everywhere. Different systems and states and institutions are looking at the reduced credit hour baccalaureate degree. Yet it is still pretty early in the process. So let's talk a little bit about what it is. It's considered a purpose-built option for select programs and students. It's often, but not always, aligned with workforce degrees. It serves all kinds of different students. I mean, it's really hard to put a limit on who could benefit from this type of opportunity. But let's be clear that it's not a system-wide replacement for an 120-credit degree that exists currently in policy. It's not going to be appropriate for all majors, and it's not a reduction in rigor. So that's where we'll start our conversation. Why are we having the conversation now? Again, it is a hot topic amongst the higher education world, and in many cases, legislatures have started to talk about it. It is important as we discuss our options, we need to keep in mind we need to establish guardrails as we go along in the conversation. So one of the questions that comes up an awful lot when we talk about programs and changes to academic programs is what are the accreditors saying? So currently all four of the formerly regional accreditation groups, including our own Northwest Commission on Colleges and Universities, provide a structured pathway for an exception where these reduced credit baccalaureate degrees can be approved. And again, the emphasis is on there's extra structure here while we're still figuring out what these things look like. The first group in the West of reduced credit baccalaureate degrees were offered by BYU-Idaho, which is part of the Northwest Commission, just like we are. And in that case, they had a few degrees approved, and so there's a list there, including applied business management. You can see the focus is on some applied degrees in other areas of high workforce need. There have been other state actions outside of Idaho, Utah, Indiana, and Maine have different approaches. And we won't go into details today about those different approaches because I want to make sure we have time for our guest presenter from Weber State in Utah. And we will get quickly to her so she can share the information of what they're experiencing in their implementation. So policy focus areas, this slide just reiterates what I said earlier, which is different states have different approaches to what will the reduced credit degrees look like and what kind of degrees can qualify, as well as other limitations that are set in policy. Right now in NCHE policy, the standard number of credits, as you all know, is 120 credits and no more, no less. And so if you, in the past, degrees exceeded the 120, we still have some that have exceptions based on usually accreditation requirements or licensing requirements. But by and far, the large majority of our degrees are 120 credits. Of course, I'm talking about our bachelor's degrees. Moving forward, so originally when this presentation was put together, the tentative plan was to come back in June with two items, one, a possible authorizing policy for the board's consideration, as well as we have an institution, Great Basin College, who's waiting in the wings with a program, which I'll talk about in a second, that they would like to request approval for. They've been busy working on innovations on their campus and would like very much to bring the degree forward. We definitely have been working with Academic Affairs Council on this topic. We had a very robust conversation yesterday when we met. And the consensus is that this is something we need to do. This is something we can put off for very far in the future. But yet we do need to have deeper conversations on our campuses, in particular with our faculty, due to the curricular implications, as well as it really is a measure that could change our system forever. So it's a big deal. But again, we can't, you know, do what sometimes we get accused of in higher education, which is just put it off for a very long time. So we have to kind of find the right balance there between moving forward with something that we need to do to innovate and support students, support the workforce, but yet do it in a way that allows input from all of the necessary points. So the first potential program will be the Great Basin College Bachelor of Applied Science. I am not an expert in that program. I know President Donnelly, obviously, and Vice President Sarah Negrete are the experts there. But we just wanted to recognize that this one is waiting in the wings as we begin these conversations. We need to move. So now I am going to transition over to our guest speaker, Gail Nicholson from Weber State, and she is joining us virtually so she can talk about Utah's jump into the sub-120 credit degree area. And I'll go ahead and advance the slides when you tell me to do so. Go ahead, Gail.
Great, thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Hi, can
sure
you hear
can.
Me?
Please continue.
Great.
Sure
Thank
can.
You so
Please
much.
Continue.
Great. Thanks. My name is Gail Nicholson. I'm from Weber State University in Ogden, Utah. And I really appreciate the opportunity to come and talk and share the experiences we've had in the state of Utah. It's an interesting area. It's generated a lot of buzz and at the same time a healthy amount of debate across the higher ed landscape. Sub-120. There are a lot of different names that we've been hearing for these new degrees: sub-120, accelerated bachelor's, reduced credit bachelor's, 90 credit hour bachelor's. We're in the state of Utah, or we're calling them bachelor's of applied studies, or a BAP degree. But ultimately, the conversation is about redefining the baccalaureate degree to prioritize affordability and workforce alignment without sacrificing the quality of the education we provide. Overall, jump up to slide 2. Sorry, I can't see the slides. So why now? Why are we challenging the kind of the century-old 120 credit hour bachelor degree? And we've defined four main drivers for this innovation. First of all, the first concern we're trying to address is concern about affordability of higher ed overall. By shifting to a 90 credit hour degree, we're looking at potentially reducing the cost, total cost of a degree by 25% for some students. Translates into savings of 30 credit hours on the semester system in tuition and fees, and that can be a game changer for some students and affordability generally. Secondly, the driver of time to degree. The model accelerates a student's entry into the workforce by a full year. This is a very attractive consideration for non-traditional students in particular, which is a large audience at our institution and in many other regional. Third, we've considered the value proposition of the sub-120 degree. We are acutely aware of the growing public skepticism regarding the investment the ROI in four-year degrees generally. And this is one way we can respond to that skepticism with an actionable solution. At Weber State, our intent for the sub-120 of applied studies is also incorporates a required internship. So it also supports kind of the workforce need, which was our fourth area that we've identified. In Utah, we need to rapidly fill high demand gaps in our economy with skilled graduates. We think the sub 120 model allows us to directly demonstrate better alignment with industry needs and get qualified professionals in the field more quickly, and develop a more agile workforce. Okay, next slide, please. The initial concern expressed by our faculty, and I already heard, and I heard it in one of your comments earlier, the concern about quality and rigor. We have worked diligently to convey the message that this is about efficiency. It's not creating a college light experience. They're not simply chopped versions of old degrees. They are thoughtfully and deliberately built from the ground up. And we've looked at several strategies to consider when looking at the sub 120 degrees. One easy way is the elimination of electives and focusing strictly on the major requirements in the core gen ed curriculum. This approach can be, again, very appealing to the non-traditional student. A group of students generally know when they come back to school, they know what they want, and they want to get through quickly and efficiently. What is vital, though, is when we talk about this, is that the program still meet the same essential learning outcomes as the traditional 120 credit hour degree. We're also looking at leveraging stackability. These degrees may be designed to stack directly on top of a 60 credit hour associate degree. We've had great success in one degree like this, so that 60 credits along with the gen ed requirements. Then another model that we have considered is one that focuses and encourages interdisciplinarity between programs. This pushes our faculty to creatively integrate courses from a variety of programs to meet emerging market demands. Okay, next slide. So we can look at some of the early adopters and concrete examples. In my home institution at Weber State, we have several approved programs. We launched an applied politics, philosophy, and economics. So this is an interdisciplinary degree program that was built from the ground up. We also will launch in the fall a sound production and recording program that was a well-established and very popular associate degree. The faculty went out to the community, to the employers, determined that one extra year with very focused technical expertise would allow these students to be employable at a higher salary, and jobs were abundant. We're currently considering sub 120 credit degrees in elementary education, special education, outdoor and community recreation. Education has been interesting. We have worked with the state office of education to ensure that a sub 120 will still qualify our students to sit for licensure and be qualified instructors. Utah Valley University is offering programs in emergency services, supervision, and professional, again, which are strategically designed to stack into a 120 credit hour professional advancement degree. So they're taking a little bit further. We do owe a lot to our private partners who ran the initial pilots, Ensign College and BYU Idaho, as was previously mentioned. Other areas we are seeing being considered from throughout the state are information technology, human resources management, rural entrepreneurship, aviation management, and then an accounting with a master's dual track, so a three-year accounting degree leading into a master's of accounting. And then finally, the last slide, I think. Critics all over the place, right? So these are some of the challenges that we have identified and are actively navigating. A major concern is graduate school acceptance. There's ongoing work to ensure that master's programs, especially in specialized fields like engineering or medicine, will recognize and admit students holding 90 credit hour degrees. We've had to thoughtfully address a two-tiered concern. Critics of the model often argued that it could inadvertently create a two-tiered system where lower-income students are pushed to the shorter, faster degrees, while wealthier students continue to pursue the traditional full four-year experience. This is an equity issue that we are monitoring closely. And finally, as mentioned before as well, there are accreditation limits. Not all disciplines are eligible for a reduced credit hour degree. programmatic accreditors for fields like nursing or engineering still largely require the traditional 120 credit hour degree. So where do we go from here? The UC system has set a strategic goal to increase timely completion by 3% over the next 5 years. And we are fully expecting expansion of the sub 120 credit hour bachelor degree within our system. We have verified the U.S. Department of Education has confirmed that students enrolled in these 90 credit programs remain fully eligible for Title IV federal financial aid funding, and that we think is a fairly massive hurdle that has been cleared. So that's been our experiences. I do want to also advise that Northwest is an excellent partner in pursuing these. They've provided us with excellent guidance and support through these processes, because they too, of course, are very concerned that these developed are good, rigorous degrees that lead to good jobs. Thank you very much. I can take any questions if it's time.
Thank you, Ms. Nicholson. If you could just definitely be ready for us, because we have an inquisitive group of committee members. So if you can just give us a minute or two. We're going to start down. Oh, I'm sorry, Ms. Davis. Do you have any more input down there in Las Vegas?
I see some.
On your side.
Oh, on my side, no. Thank you.
None heard. We're going to go to committee members with questions. We're going to start down at CSN. There are three of the committee members down in Las Vegas. Do you have any questions, comments?
Yes.
Please continue.
Regent Arascotta. This is Regent Del Carl. I have a question. So my question to, I forget the speaker's name at Weber State. What? Do you have to go to each accrediting body?
We do not have the board meeting on our video up here in Reno. Can you help us out with this?
Another question. Can I proceed, Regent Arascotta?
Ms. Nicholson, if you could, Ms. Nicholson, excuse me, if you could be on hold for just one moment. We're having a few technical glitches problems right now that seems to be completely out of our control up here in Reno. So if you can give us a minute or two, we'd appreciate it. Testing, testing. Anyone in Vegas can hear us? Or at the College of Southern Nevada? Wonderful night. Ms. Nicholson, if you don't mind taking a question from our Vice Chair, Regent Downs, that'd be great.
Thank you, Chair Escada. So I guess I'm trying to understand the whole purpose of this, unless it's just to grab more enrollment by offering something that people don't have to spend as much time and money on. And so, I mean, that, one of my questions are, what does a degree possess? Why do we create 120 credit degrees such that now we can just say, well, we don't need 30 of those credits? So that was all, as you call them, fluff. Why don't we just take fluff out of everything? I mean, why don't we make them all 90 credit degrees? And I'm going to answer my own question, but I'd love to get your response too. I mean, my understanding of the purpose of a bachelor's degree is it's a well-rounded, it's not like a technical degree where you're learning one specific thing. It gives you a well-rounded background. So even though I'm a math person, I still took women's studies. I still took several history classes. I think I took Spanish. I mean, I took a wide range of classes to give me a well-rounded understanding of the world. And that's my understanding of what the purpose of the GE and the fluff is in a degree. And so to start cutting those things out makes me wonder what is reducible, what can be taken out of a degree and to still be a degree. And I guess that's where my concern is with this, is are we either creating something that is less than something else and setting up students for, I wouldn't say failure, but for a different status, as you mentioned, the two-tier status, or have we been misleading students all along by making them take classes they didn't really need to take? So I'd love to get your take on that.
So I don't want to suggest that Gen Ed is fluff. And I think what this process does is put a greater focus on general education to ensure that, because within the state of Utah, students must complete the traditional gen ed program even in a sub 120 credit hour degree. So that puts more focus on a robust, well-rounded gen ed program. But I can give you a personal example. I majored in a social science area. I probably had 20, 25 hours of extra elective credit, which for me worked well because I changed my major six times. But for a student, a non-traditional student in particular, who wants to get in, knows exactly what they want to do, these degrees can get them through the program with good credentials and out into the workforce more quickly with less debt that they're having to take on. The key is also to develop good, rigorous programs. So learning outcomes are the key to developing these, that we identify the outcomes first for these programs and then build the programs based on those outcomes and assess along the way to ensure that students are mastering those outcomes at the level expected of a bachelor's degree.
Ms. Nicholson, if you could, we're going to hold off on additional comments or questions. As I look on the internet, on our live feed, none of this is being broadcast whatsoever. And I'm looking on our INSHE website and also on any sort of live broadcast. Nothing is being heard. So if we can take just a 10-minute break, we'd appreciate it. Thank you much. Oh, hold on. You guys look like you're back. SES, 10-minute break, please. I want to express great appreciation for everybody in attendance today, all the committee members, everybody. I know that we've had a lot of technical issues since the onset of this meeting, and it's greatly frustrating up here and through an entire system that is trying to be patient with this process. But we really want to focus on Ms. Nicholson, who was speaking to us from Weber State University. And I'm not sure that everyone was able to hear her or watch or follow the screens and her slides, but there was very informative. One of the questions, is Ms. Nicholson back on or still on?
I'm here.
Fantastic. Once again, I hope that everybody did hear her presentation. We're not going to start from the onset of it again because I'm 100% positive this agenda item is going to be coming back to us. But Regent Downs, you did ask a pivotal question, if you can still remember that great question, to Ms. Nicholson regarding the 90 credit program. I don't know, whichever one sounds good to you.
Well, I would like to see a comparison of a 120 degree and a 90 degree to see what has been eliminated. And because I think it goes more to the philosophy of what a college degree is, or have we been overcharging students and making them take classes they don't need? I don't think so. I think what we offer in a degree is important. So I guess I'd like to see what is it that's different about one of these 90 credit degrees, and are we placing a value proposition on those 30 credits that other students take, but the group, the students in this program aren't going to take? So if there's, I know this will have to come back because it's information only. But I'd like to see that comparison.
So the approach we are taking is that we are not taking current 120s and cutting away. That is an approach some institutions are taking. That is not the approach largely within the state of Utah, and particularly not at Weber State. We are building these basically from the ground up. And again, with the set of student outcomes that we want to see students achieve at the end, by the time they're through, completed with the degree, and we develop the courses and the coursework deliberately to support the mastering of those outcomes.
I appreciate that, and I totally understand if you build it from the ground up. My perspective would be it's still lacking something that the other degrees had. I mean, you can still crosswalk over and say math, math, English, English, but what's missing here? Is there history, history? Is there something else that's missing? And that's where I want to look and see what are we being asked to approve with this kind of modified degree. So I know we're low on time, so I won't belabor the point. We can go to the next person. Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair Downs. Anyone from the committee have any questions? Regent Del Carlo?
Oh, thank you. I do have a question. You said you'd have to be reviewed by the Northwest Commission. I think there's, isn't there a total of six commissions, different commissions? I think there's six. But
six or
so
seven,
if,
yes.
If it's approved by the Northwest Commission, will we have a problem if another one of the commissions, like the South one, won't accept the credit? I mean, is there a governing body over the commissions? I don't think there is, other than the Department of Education. So will somebody oversee all this? Because I do see this as a trend, and I've been saying for a long time that our students are different than when I went to school 50 years ago. I mean, really, it's a different world, and these kids are so much more, I see them as more advanced because of the technology and the things they're exposed to at such a younger age, that I am really intrigued by this concept of going from 120 to 90. And I see it mostly, I haven't compared like Regent Downs was asking, but I would think it's a lot of the electives. And, you know, people will argue that makes you more well-rounded. But, you know, for so many people that have limited finances, you know, they just want to come in and get their degree if this is the type of degree they can do in 90 credits and get working. I mean, that's why dual enrollment is exploding. These kids want to get through school on a quicker pace and get out into the workforce. And frankly, we need them out in the workforce. So I just wondered about the accreditation part and how you guys have navigated that. Because if you're able to do it, then we're in the same Northwest. But will that transfer over to the other bodies? Thank you.
So my understanding is that all of the institutional accreditation agencies have approved sub 120s, at least on a pilot basis. But we don't transfer a completed degree necessarily. We use a completed degree to go to grad school perhaps. And the question there is absolutely on the table. Will schools accept a sub 120 bachelor's degree for their graduate programs? And we have just started working internally with that, working within our own grad schools and asking them, if we create a sub 120 degree in this area, will you accept these students in your grad programs? And I'll be honest, some are saying absolutely, and some are saying, we're not sure, right? So definitely good questions. And then we'll extend that to the state, because most of our students stay within the state when they go to grad school. But that is absolutely a question that is open and needs to be addressed. There's a consortium called College in Three that I would recommend you consider joining, which is a consortium of schools around the country that are investigating this. This is run by Robert Zemsky and Madeline Green, and they're doing extensive research on enrollments, on graduation, on next step success for these students. And so I would recommend somebody from the Nevada system consider joining that consortium. They meet every once a year, and they've in professional development speakers throughout the year. That might help address some of the concerns.
Thank you, Ms. Dixon. Committee members, Batista or Brown, any questions, comments?
Yeah, Regent Brown.
Please.
Thank you, Regent Brown, for the record. I really appreciate that, obviously, this is put together as a pilot program. I think that would give us a lot of, time to test this out. I was also, I was kind of Googling and figuring out all the other, thank you for our guest speaker from Weber University and a couple other Utah universities, and this is starting to be adopted. I also started looking abroad just to confirm, and it's like Cambridge University offers a 3-year degree, 4-year for engineering and specialized degrees. But for me, I know if we can reduce cost and time to degree, that's going to be helpful. We've already kind of started addressing that in other avenues. And I also know that higher education needs to modernize when it can. We make this joke, I make this joke quite a bit about YouTube University, and people feel like they can learn things offline, and but we still, there's obviously always going to be a value about coming here, but if we can strip it down bare bones for the people who want to get into the workforce, I think that would be ultimately really appealing to a lot of our constituents in Nevada. So I'm glad that this is presented information only. We can continue to talk about it, but also as a pilot program, just so we can start testing and getting some statistics afterwards. So thank you.
Wonderful input. Thank you very much, Regent Brown and Regent DeCarlo.
I have another question, Chair Arascotta, when it's my turn again. Thank you.
Oh, fire away, please.
Okay, thank you. So this is to Ms. Nicholson. So you're taking the courses from the ground up. So that course that you've just developed for the 90-degree credit program, so if I'm on a four-year degree program, am I going to be able to take your course, or is there going to be a different course for the same subject for me on a four-year path?
So we've developed the programs from the ground up, largely using existing courses. So a specific class may have students from a variety of programs in it, and there will be no distinction. The learning outcomes at the course level will be the same for a four-year degree as it is for a three-year degree. The instructors within the class don't really know that. We've actually not had to develop very many brand new courses to support these programs. Again, the interdisciplinary ones are looking at how they can put together existing courses for the most part, develop maybe an introductory course about what this major is about, and then focusing in our programs, on a culminating internship project that allows them to pull together their learning.
Okay, my last question is, what was the impetus for Webb's Weaver University to go to this? What did you guys, what was the aha moment for you?
We try to stay very much in tune with our legislature and what we're hearing from them, and efficiency and reduced time to graduation resonates with our legislature, and we listen to them closely.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I want to thank everybody for being involved with this process. And similar to agenda item number 9, this agenda item regarding time to degree program, it will unquestionably be readdressed well before our next quarterly meeting, most likely during a special meeting in April. Want to give fair warning to everybody on that one. Thank you very much for everyone involved with this. We are going to swiftly move on to agenda item number 12, which is system-wide general education requirements. Associate Vice Chancellor for Academic and Student Affairs, Renee Davis, will do a information-only item. That will be 15 minutes or under. Thank you very much. Ms. Davis, please continue.
Okay, but I just lost 10 seconds here with your introduction, so can I have that back?
I know.
Okay.
Blah, 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 blah.
Renee Davis, Associate Vice Chancellor for Academic and Student Affairs. So this presentation is yet another really important conversation we need to have as a system. This is about system-wide general education challenges and opportunities. And, you know, we do have some really great building blocks in place. We have Common Course numbering. We have some very robust transfer agreements for a very high percentage of our programs that result in an even transfer for students. However, we do still have some gaps. And so really we need to build upon the successes that we already have in place. And this slide goes a little bit over the gaps. So if a student completes the associate degree at one of our community colleges, then when they transfer to one of the Nevada universities, their lower division general ed is considered complete. So it doesn't matter in terms of, you don't have to do a course-by-course examination. The students are considered complete in the lower division general ed. And that's based on board policy. So that's a great start, along with those other building blocks I mentioned. For those students who don't complete their associate degree, then it gets a little more complicated, and courses have to transfer one by one and meet requirements, whether it's for general education, for the degree, or in some cases, electives. So we've talked a lot about systemness, and really this is a conversation all about systemness. How can we leverage the fact that we're all together in a system and continue to build on supports for students and increase student success. Since 2010, and probably before, general education reform has been one of the most significant widespread higher education policy changes. A lot of states and systems are working on this and have worked on this. So another consideration why we need to be looking at this topic is that our students move around a lot, and whether they swirl between our community colleges and our universities, back and forth, we know that happens a lot, and there are lots of reasons for that, which I don't have, frankly, time to go into, but we know it is something real, and the more they move around, the more we need to figure out how to make things smooth for them as they do move from institution to institution. Also, we have an increasing number of students taking dual credit in high school, and they may start doing dual credit with one institution in Nevada and go elsewhere when they start their college career. And we do have a 27% Nevada transfer out rate, as well as our adult completion rate is a little bit below the average. So we have a lot of things that we need to work on. Basically, this is a conversation we return to frequently, which is how do we make things more seamless for students, more efficient for them, and give them confidence that they can come to a college in Nevada and successfully complete and enter the workforce. This slide, I'm not going to get buried in. It's just basically the point here is that there have been kind of there's a ladder of reforms that have happened in the general ed area, and we've engaged in the first few. We're about halfway up that ladder, and so we have some work to do here in this area. So here's an example from Texas where there is a general ed requirement for the system. And so I'm not going to go into all the elements here, but you can see there are various categories or a certain number of credits in each category, and this applies to all of the institutions in the system. Now, when you look at ENCHI, you can see that there is alignment in certain areas. You know, everyone has to take 6 hours of English composition, at least 3 hours of math, depending upon your for the general education requirements. Then, of course, that will be different for your degree requirements if you're in STEM. And then 7 hours in natural sciences. And then from that point on, it starts to be a little bit different institution to institution. So social sciences, it may be 3, 6, or 9 hours. Students can satisfy the Nevada Constitution and Nevada and U.S. Constitution requirement in a couple different ways, depending on the institution. Humanities could be 3 or 6. Fine arts could be 3 or 6. And then there's the concept of a capstone kind of over the whole general ed experience, and that is where things really differentiate between institutions. The point of this slide here is just that we're pretty small compared to other systems, so if the big ones can do it, we can do it. I have confidence because we do so much work collaboratively and together. I've led so many task forces in my time at the system, so we can work together and figure this out. But that's the key point, is we need to work together and we need to be transparent about this work as we engage in it. Just another example, in the interest of time, I'm going to skip through this one. And then this slide is just the fact that the whole point of having a core gen ed requirement, we're talking about having a certain number of credits, which we do have some generic outlines in policy, but defining that better and making it, you can take that as a package. So you don't have to earn the associate degree to not have to retake anything in the gen ed core when you transfer, but you can take it anywhere and you can go community college to university, community college to community college, university to university, and the whole gamut. So that's the point of this slide here. And then this is just an example of what it would look like on a transcript, an example from Kansas where the system-wide general education is marked as completed on the student's transcript. And so when that's done, it's done. Rather than the current practice that I alluded to where it's a class-by-class articulation. So in these states that do have a system-wide general ed, what happens if they don't complete that core of general education? There's a list of courses that's agreed upon system-wide that meets that requirement. So in this case, the student would transfer, and then they would just have to take one course off that list to complete the gen ed, so they don't lose all the other progress that they made as part of that process. And do we have clear system-wide definitions for which courses belong in each general ed category? Clear at the institution level, but not clear. There's no common definition at the system level. And interest of time, these are just all examples. I think the concept is actually pretty simple. Achieving it is not so simple, but the concept is simple. And that's all I have for that one. Happy to entertain questions.
Thank you so much, Ms. Davis. Jeff, Regent Downs, question? No? Yes?
Thank you, Ms. Davis. I'm trying to think who your official title is. Vice Chancellor Davis or Associate Vice Chancellor? Anyway, I appreciate your work on this, and I think having a common general education system would be most beneficial to students. That's what I requested. I appreciate the work you and your team have done on this, and the graphics really tell a lot. I like that, where it goes, shows that big fanning out of all the different pathways that students may have to take for their GE. So it would be nice. I know some schools may not be happy to have to be aligned with other schools, but it'd be nice for the students' sake if they would be able to not have to look at so many different branches. Just be able to take something and realize, wait a second, I think I really want that degree over at UNLV, and they're going to transfer over there, and it's not going to be an upset in the course they've already taken. So appreciate you putting this together.
Thank you, Regent Downs. And I just want to underscore my comment earlier is that launching into this work, it definitely will be a collaborative effort with all of our campuses. It's not going to be someone at the system level is going to tell everyone what to do. It really has to be a conversation with all of our campuses, and it will be, it's a big lift. It's a lot of conversations because, you know, unlike the co-requisite project, which we had math and English in advising, now we have every discipline that is taught in our system. So it's big, but it's an important step to take.
True, and I hope that everyone can collaborate together to come up with a GE that reflects what is important in the degrees across the system.
Thank you, Vice Chair Downs. I know the word systemness is often celebrated by Regent Brown. Regent Brown or Regent O'Connor or Batista? Questions?
Yes, Chair. Thank you. Shout out to our former Chancellor Del Urquiagua for putting that into my brain. It's never leaving. And in an effort for more systeminess, I do think that this 36 Gen Ed block will be so helpful for our students to not lose time, momentum, and save money. And we really are demonstrating that matriculation is possible and easier without any additional roadblocks. I also want to acknowledge that I know the lift will not be easy, but it will make all the difference in the end. And so I just want to preemptively thank all of our staff on each of our campuses for being collaborative in this effort and getting us one step closer to truly being a system that works for all of our students where they are and meeting them and helping them through the process. So thank you.
Thank you, Regent or Chair Erskata. I just agree with what Regent Brown said. I think this is really important to our whole concept of systemness. I do like that word too. And we are small. We're mighty. We're small. But we can do this. And it's just a matter of sitting down at the table and just hashing it out as we've done in the past. You know, we put together the transfer and articulation that went very, very well. And not everyone's going to get everything they want 100%, but that's why you sit down and you negotiate it through. And we're here to do the best job for our students, to help them. And this really makes sense for our system. So I really appreciate the work that's already gone into this. I know there's a lot of work ahead, and I look forward to this coming back to the board and taking a vote so we can put you on fast forward. Thank you. Renee, and thank you for stepping up into this role. You do a great job for us. Thank you.
Well stated. Very well stated, Regent Del Carlo. Spot on with that. Ms. Davis, thank you very much. We're going to move on to agenda item number 13. With the agenda item number 13, the experimental math program proposal at CSN, at the College of Southern Nevada, Executive Vice President of Academic Affairs, James McCoy, will request approval. Mr. Dr. McCoy, or Renee, go right ahead.
Chair Scotto, with your permission, I'd just like to say a couple words of thank you to CSN. Both Vice President McCoy and Dr. Pandey, because they have worked so hard on this proposal, and all the math faculty, because I know it was a team, it wasn't just one faculty member. And this work has come from a sincere desire to improve and support students who aren't currently successful. And so it's a really important step, and I look forward to their presentation.
Thank you, Ms. Davis. And Dr. McCoy and Dr. Pandey, if you can, we're going to keep this under 15 minutes. I do honor and everything that you all do, but Dr. McCoy, with your verbosity, you have a tendency of going a little long on this. So let's go ahead and keep it under 15 there, gentlemen.
You got it, Chair. James McCoy, Executive Vice President for Academic Affairs, and I will take that with great seriousness. In fact, I'll do it in about 30 seconds because I want to hand this over directly to our math faculty member. I want to just acknowledge that in 2019, this board, and some of you were in this board at that moment, passed the co-requisite Gateway Math and English policy that allowed for us to do things differently in the context of math and English. We were seeing single-digit, in some cases, completion rates. And so, like much of the rest of the country, engaging in the co-requisite reform work was a serious work, serious lift of this whole system. The board at that time had the foresight to write into policy a provision that allows for institutions to, after a proper assessment, allowing faculty to discern what's working and what's not working in the context of student learning outcomes within the co-requisite model. And our math faculty across the state, no doubt, and certainly here at CSN, have taken that with great seriousness. Now, 6 years later, we have some data. And to sit on that data and not bring to this board the opportunity to allow for an exception in the context of a pilot would be foolish. And so our math faculty have designed a pilot that Dr. Pandey is going to share with you right now, and we plead for your acceptance of this opportunity for an exception for us to study this. I will also just say, on behalf of CSN, we all stand behind this pilot. There is a cost piece to it. There is a registrar piece to it. There is a financial aid element to it, and perhaps most importantly, a heavy curricular lift to it. And we all stand together to present to provide this pilot to you. So with that, I'll turn it over to Dr. Pandey, who's been leading this effort at CSN.
Thank you, Dr. McCoy. My name is Alok Pandey, A-L-O-K, first name, P-A-N-D-E-Y, last name, math professor here at CSN. Mr. Chair, Regent Arascada, Vice Chair, Regent Downs, members, Regents Batista, Regent Brown, and Regent Del Carlo. We have 15 minutes, and I promise I will finish it before that. So in this presentation, we just want to share the CSN data that will identify a problem, some possible solutions, and then proposed parachute course, timeline, how we plan to evaluate it, and how does the curriculum look like, and what is the institutional investment in that. So in fall 2021, I was chair of math department then at CSN, board implemented a core requisite model for English and math that basically required that no more remedial courses. This, at least in math, no placement was needed, and math gateway courses became pre-calculus math 126E, This is a 3+3, 6-credit course, College Algebra, Math 124, at least at CSN. It is 3+2, 5-credit, three for the Math 124 part and 2 core requisite part, and then Liberal Arts Math, which is 3+2-credit again. 3-credit goes to the Math 120 course and 2-credit for the core requisite model. After 6 years, 21 through spring of 2025, here is the pass rate. If you look at the top line, that basically gives you the pass rate from grade A through C minus. The bottom red line reduces the pass rate because what we did is we included the W's and those people who dropped the class and got W, and those who dropped the class before they got the W. So as you know that at most institutions, there is a period when students can drop the class without getting W. So when you include that, that number reduces further. So here are numeric values rather than graph. And so the best rate was 53.3 pass rate in fall 21 and 38.8 summer 22. If you take average pass rate of all 11 semesters, it is 46.8%. When you add the students who are dropped or who receive W, the average reduces to 48.5% for fall 21, 29.4% for summer 21, and the overall average reduces to 41.6%. And basically, that's where the problem lies. So, what is the problem? The problem is that the pre-calculus math course is a requirement for almost every STEM degree. With not having a 126, you can't go into engineering, you can't go into medicine, you can't go into just about any course or any degree. So that's the problem. The second problem, it is the first course that students take, whether at CSN or at our universities and colleges. When you fail that course in the first year, and I was an international student, I was a student on a scholarship, you will lose the scholarship because you suddenly got F in a 6-credit course. Number three, your GPA, right at the very first semester, you know, you got 6 times 0 in the calculation of GPA. So those are very serious problems. This is the problem. And then most probably devastating will be that a student leave the STEM stream. So those are some of the serious problems and what the possible solutions maybe is A, we can return to remedial model. Board current policy does not permit that, allows that. And I'm not here to propose that either. We want to help students additionally. CSN has been trying. We have supplement instructional tutors in our classrooms. We have started even summer boot camps. So we are doing those things that we can. But I think, and along with me, my colleagues in the math department here at CSN, we looked into solutions. And I do want to acknowledge Vice Chair Downs because at our core requisite conference, this proposal of designing a parachute course where a student who is not performing well in the beginning of the semester, before too late, dropped into a parachute course. And they continue in that course. That's the purpose. There is a research paper published out of University of New Mexico where they tried this on a physics course from 2009 to 2016, where the success rate, students getting less than C in the parachute course was less than 20%, and that gave the impetus to us to propose this this course. So if you look at it, by the way, this proposal was presented first in our math department. It was debated, and those of you, I'm sure all of you know, CSN has a very large math department. We have about 50 full-time faculty members. So it's a pretty, and it's a pretty diverse group. So it was debated, and this proposal is unanimously supported by the math faculty at CSN. So what our proposal is that all participating sections will be given the same curriculum, first 4 weeks, same assignment, same quizzes, same test. They will be evaluated based on their assignment, participation, test, quizzes. And at the end of the 4 weeks, the instructor of the record will look at the students who are not performing. In the 5th week, they will meet with those students and recommend to them that they go into the parachute course, which will help them pass through it. It is voluntary. If a student doesn't want to go into the parachute course, it is their choice. The parachute course remains a 6-credit course, and the reason for that is that the financial aid has been distributed before this decision is made. And so we have been advised to keep it that way. It will be 6-credit course, 4 will be given to math, and 2 will be given to study skill. It has been found that the students fail not as much out of fear of math, but they just still don't have the study skills to study at college. So that is, and from the 6th week to the 16th week, we will devote in the parachute course on the core material that prepares them for the pre-calculus success in subsequent semester. Our implementation plan is to, if it is approved, to start with 6 sections of pilot in fall 2026, and we will continue this till spring 2028, 6-credit. By the way, the more important part is impact on students, so there will be no impact on students. The original Math 126E that they originally enrolled, it will be removed from the record. They will be enrolled into equivalent 6-credit. The financial aid will continue. And if they get C or better, they do not have to take the expanded 126E. They can go straight into Math 126. Our belief is that study skill portion will help them not just in this course, but all the college university level courses that they will take in future. By the way, the meeting time is going to be exactly same. So if a student started at 11 a.m., the parachute course will also start at 11 a.m. In the subsequent semesters or how we will do, it will depend on the success. But at this point in the fall, we have scheduled it to be at the same time. So no student, at least at CSN, all the students have work and other obligations. So we want to make sure that their schedule is not disturbed. So our implementation timeline is basically we have developed the curriculum. Our department, again, unanimously has approved. We are still working on the study plan. The committee is looking at it. We will take it to the department at every level. So our plan is that in the summer we will develop the these student in parachute course will be given a handout book type too to show their learning. In fall 2026, we will develop the first six, we will offer first six parachute courses. In the spring, again, we will repeat the same thing. In the summer of 2027, we will develop the year one report, and we will provide that to Chief Academic Officer Dr. McCoy and to the Chancellor. Our goal is that in the next academic year, fall 2027, we will go with, again, six parachute courses. And in the spring, we will see what changes do we have to make in our own curriculum, offering, credit hours, workload, timing, to see if there is what it is saying, what the data is saying, basically. We may bring another request to the board, or we might provide the report and you guys can make some other decision. So this is a two-year experimental program. The curriculum, the committee developed, presented it to the department. At this point, the study skill part is not done, and the curriculum is supported. I want to assure the committee members that this is not a developmental or a placement course. This is an in-semester intervention with guaranteed forward-looking moment, and this course provides helps. It does not delay the progress, or it does not cause a intervention. It does not cause a disturbance in their academic goal. It supports their academic goal. We will evaluate this based on ENSHE curriculum model that we have. I'm not reading all of that, but we will have a committee that will oversee the curriculum and results and everything. And the last one is institutional investment. There is an administrative cost. We don't have money on it. But, of course, the registrar will have to manually remove the students from one section, put them into another section. The faculty cost is approximately $34,000, and tutoring cost will be around $4,600. That's my presentation, and I'm open. My department chair is here. Dr. McCoy is here, and we can answer any question that anyone has.
Dr. Pandey, thank you very much. That was a great presentation. The last couple slides really stuck out to us up here in the north. However, I'm going to divert back to my colleagues down in the south of the ARSA committee, and we're going to go ahead and go with any of questions from the committee members. Please go ahead.
This is Regent Del Carlo. I'm very supportive of this. I think it's brilliant. I really appreciate that you got together. It was your own idea because you saw that what we had tried to do with co-requisite, which I still really believe in, wasn't working properly. And this is a large amount of students that go into STEM. And I didn't realize you had 50 math classes. I know you guys are big, but wow, when you put the numbers on it. So this is telling, hopefully, the faculty hears that the Regents are listening to you. We're listening to you. Because when we put that in 2019, nothing was ever in concrete. I mean, we go to these conferences. Thank you, Jeff, Vice Chair Downs, for going to that conference on co-requisite. I mean, when we go to these conferences, we learn from our peers around the country and what they're doing, and we bring those ideas home. So I am 1,000% in favor of this, and I look forward to you coming back in 28 and telling us how successful this is, because you've got the buy-in of the faculty, and I really appreciate, because you guys want these students to succeed. I want them to succeed. So if this is the new change to our co-requisite, absolutely, let's do it for our students. We want them to succeed. And my colleague next door to me just, President Dinelli said something about if you're a Nevada Promise student and you fail, then you go on suspension. So you didn't say that. She told me that, which, you know, we're not down in the weeds. I don't know that. So this is really important to help our students, and thank you so much. And I'm really sorry we're running over today, too, but this is a heavy committee. This is the core of what we do on the board and for our students. So thank you, and it's nice to see you again. I haven't seen you since you were the faculty senate chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Regent Del Carlo.
Regent Del Carlo, thank you for those thoughtful words. We appreciate it. Regent Batista, Regent Brown, questions?
I'm good, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Vice Chair Downs?
Thank you, Chair. I wanted first to give you a lot of praise and credit for your presentation. This is, from my experience, this is an actual policy proposal. So you did a good job. You presented options, alternatives to solve a problem, and I like the path you're going on here. I do want to highlight that, is that number really accurate, that 41.6% pass rate, which means 58.4% of the students who start Math 126E do not pass it at CSN on that, average?
I think my number is accurate, but what I also want to add, that is not just CSN reflection. I venture to say that this number will be plus minus few percent across the system.
Well, I'm not challenging that, nor am I trying to disparage CSN. I would be interested to see the numbers system-wide, and I believe that Vice Chancellor Archer once brought forward the challenges that the system was having with Math 126 as a co-requisite, whatever it's entitled, at different institutions. I know some call it 26-126 and 126E and so on. But I don't want to belabor the point. I know we're behind schedule here. But I just want to say that I think this is a great idea. I appreciate it whenever we talked about it at the co-requisite conference. And I like seeing what you have here. And I don't want to say anything that discourages anyone from it. But what you have when a student is, let's say a student goes over to the parachute course, they've already paid the money, or Pell has paid the money, or however the money gets paid for that 126E, and so they're not paying money for the parachute, so there's no additional cost to the student. But that's something
correct.
That the institution's going to absorb at this time. Do you see that as a long-term decision to that the institution would, if this keeps going, if the pilot's successful, would they keep covering that cost, or would we work on a way to transfer the money paid into the 126E course to apply towards that parachute course?
I'll let Dr. McCoy answer that. But in research at other institutions where this was done for a longer period of time, the students didn't have to pay ever extra.
Well, and I'm not suggesting students pay it double. I was just wondering if there's a way, maybe that's behind the scenes situation to talk about, but that the money goes to it so it doesn't cost extra to the institution, or is it a worthwhile investment for the institution to do this, which justifies doing the parachute course?
Vice Chair Downs, James McCoy for the record, Vice President for Academics at CSN. CSN is committed to seeing this pilot through. Yes, there is a significant faculty cost. To your point, there's no additional revenue coming in to support this, and so we're going to absorb it. We're going to study, along with our math faculty, the assessment outcomes of this, and then we'll see. Because as this scales up, you saw the figures. That's per semester, and that's only for six sections. With the student population of our size and the size of other institutions across this country, that could be a significant cost. So at this point, we're committed to seeing this through the pilot years if you all approve it, and then we'll have to reassess the fiscal. But the bottom line is we don't want students to have to pay twice. We don't want them to have to pay twice without doing this whole premise, and that's exactly kind of what's happening now. The 50-plus percent of students who are not getting through are having to pay twice, but this time, or currently, twice for 2 6-credit classes. If we can get this locked in now and they go right into the 126 for those that are STEM-bound, now that's a 3-credit class, consequently saving them money anyway. But we're committed to doing this for the 2 years if you approve it.
Thank you. And do you see this as an example of where, I mean, would you be allowed to apply student access fees that are already collected towards this type of a project? Because, I mean, given that it does let students have better access to continue their schooling and, you know, increase student success.
It's a great question. James McCoy, again, for the record, that's a good question. And we'll have to explore exactly what revenue stream could be used to support the long scale approach. So I don't know that at this time, but I know that we can commit for 2 years and assess to see how this goes.
Thank you. And with that, I'd like to move to approve this.
Second. I second.
Thank you very much. There was a motion for approval from Regent Downs. And I think the second was from Regent Batista.
Yes.
Thank you very much. All in favor of the motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed? Not opposed? Motion carries. Congratulations, CSN. Make us proud.
Thank well you. Done.
Thank you very much. So we're going to go to nearly our last agenda item, which is agenda item number 14. And as we all know that everybody's in the audience and well attended today to watch Provost Thompson make this stellar presentation regarding the proposed College of Veterinary Medicine at the University of Nevada. Provost Thompson, take it away.
Thank you, Regent Arascata and members of the ARSA committee. I'm delighted to be able to say good afternoon to you. My name is Jeff Thompson. I'm the Executive Vice President and Provost at the University of Nevada, Reno. And thank you for the opportunity to present our vision for a College of Veterinary Medicine, one that is grounded in statewide need, institutional readiness, and a model that is both innovative and fiscally responsible. We have been working on this project for over 6 months, and I would like to thank by name Dr. Mike Teglis, who's a DVM in our College of Agriculture, Biotechnology, and Natural Resources, and Senior Vice Provost Vince Catalano in my office, who have done a lot of the work that I'll be presenting today. And there we go. So our state needs a veterinary school. Nevada's one of only a few states without a doctor of veterinary medicine program. We conducted a comprehensive needs analysis that confirms what many of you already know. The shortage of veterinarians is not just a workforce issue, it's a public health, food security, and animal welfare issue. The USDA designated 243 rural veterinary shortages areas in 2025, the highest on record. Douglas and Nye counties in Nevada were classified as high priority shortage zones, and Lander and Lincoln were also noted for a shortage of veterinarians. Nevada has 690 veterinarians statewide. 630 of them are in Reno and Las Vegas, which leaves our rural and agricultural communities underserved. And out-of-state training pipelines are not meeting our needs. We must build our own capacity. And I wanted to read the quote from the Las Vegas Sun. In southern Nevada, fewer available veterinarians mean longer appointment wait times, higher treatment costs, and more pet surrenders as owners cannot access or afford care, something we heard with all the stakeholders we worked with over the last 6 months. There are only 32 accredited colleges of veterinary medicine in the United States. And the closest DVM programs are hundreds of miles away. And for many Nevada students, these options are financially and logistically out of reach. Over a quarter of the applicants to vet schools now are first-generation college students, and we must create pathways that serve Nevada students and the future of our communities. Also, the veterinary job growth is expected to increase by 19% over the next 10 years, so the shortage is only going to get much worse. In our feasibility study, we've confirmed a strong demand, stakeholder support, and a viable path forward. We've consulted with clinical partners, industry leaders, and peer institutions, and come to what we believe will be a competitive tuition, approximately $26,000 a year, which is based on our regional peers. And we've seen strong philanthropic interest and are developing a funding model that blends state investment, tuition, and donor support. The University of Nevada, Reno is uniquely positioned to lead this effort in our state. We have deep strengths in agriculture, animal science, biomedical research, and veterinary science. And we own the land needed and the infrastructure for large animal veterinary practice. Our cooperative extension network spans every county and touches every aspect of animal health, from ranching and livestock to wildlife and 4-H youth. And we're already embedded in the communities most affected by this shortage. Our School of Public Health and statewide health initiatives also allow us to integrate veterinary education with public and population health, an increasingly important intersection. We've engaged with the Nevada Department of Agriculture, practicing veterinarians, and industry stakeholders, including organizations like the Cattlemen's Association and Humane Societies. We've benchmarked against successful models like Texas Tech's New School of Veterinary Medicine and used their community-based veterinary school as a pilot for us. Our internal teams across academics, research, and administration are aligned and ready to move forward. As I mentioned, we're considering a community-based distributed clinical training model as Texas Tech has implemented. This model allows us to partner with clinics and animal health providers across the state, bringing care to underserved areas while training students in real-world situations. It's a cost-effective, scalable model that aligns with our land-grant mission and rural outreach. We're also considering hospital and clinic-based models and continue to refine our proposals. So we're still in the exploratory phase and moving forward with key milestones. We will be seeking board approval to establish the college. We've already engaged with the American Veterinary Medical Association Council of Education to understand the pathways to accreditation. At some point, we will need to identify a planning dean, and we continue advancing facility planning and funding strategies. Our goal is provisional accreditation by 2028, which would lead to a launch window in the late 2020s, and our first graduating class at 2033 at the earliest. This is a long process. We're developing cost estimates for capital and operational needs. As I've stated, our funding strategy includes a mix of state investment, philanthropy, tuition, and research support. And we're committed to developing a sustainable model that delivers value to students and our state. We're committed to transparency and collaboration with NSHE leadership and this board. And we believe this is the right time, the right model, and the right institution to meet this urgent need. I tried to do this as quickly as I can. So at this point, I am open to questions.
Well done, sir. Well done. Let's go ahead and go to the dais of committee members down in Las Vegas. And actually, if I may take a moment, a little bit of liberty here before we go down to the committee members of Vegas, I also want to give recognition to Regent Boylan. Regent Boylan has been a great champion of veterinary services and is an absolute animal lover down there in Clark County. So before we continue, I just want to give recognition to Regent Boylan. But in the meantime, if we can go to the three committee members down in Las Vegas, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Chair.
Regent Del Carlo?
I think President Sandoval wanted to say something first, and he couldn't get your attention. Yeah.
Now, Ms. Chair, I apologize for interrupting you, but I wanted to chime in and first thank Provost Thompson for the presentation. There's been an extensive amount of due diligence. And also, if you've noticed in the record, and this was all students and a lot of individuals in the community that are very supportive in your public comment, but I really wanted to call out Regent Boylan for his pushing this. He talked to me about this over 2 years ago. And frankly, I I didn't know what I didn't know at the time and didn't think that this was possible, but he has been the impetus for this and has really been a driving force to bring us to the point that we are today. And I've been profoundly excited and surprised and now optimistic that this can be done and it can be done well. But again, it would not have happened without Regent Boylan, and I want to make sure everybody knew that. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're too kind, President Sandoval. Thank you.
And Chair you, Scott, President Heavey would like to say something, too.
Thank you. Interim President Heavey, for the record, I just want to commend UNR for this effort. I want to say that I 100% agree that they're the right institution to launch this program that's desperately needed by the state. And I should add that I don't think Provost Thompson should be allowed to retire until it's fully launched. But congratulations on this great effort, and we're eager to see this move forward and support UNR in any way that we can. Thank you.
We concur. Thank you, President Heavey. Regent DiCarlo, please.
Thank you, Chair Escada. This has my full support. I have a personal story. Back in 1981 or two, my niece graduated from the pre-med program at UNR, and she was from the rural areas called Story County in Virginia City. She couldn't get into a West Coast veterinary school. She did get into Ohio State, which is a fabulous school, as we know. Our President Sandoval's a grad, and Ginger Doe shared that she's a graduate there. But anyway, so her first day of class in her veterinary program, she sits by a guy whose last name's Current. 4 years later, they graduate. She marries. She never came home. And she has a beautiful wife there, but we really need this school. And, yes, thank you, Regent Boylan, because when you first said that, I mean, I was a naysayer. I mean, it was not like it couldn't happen, but, like, where the heck's the money going to come from? Because everything is about money. But you saw how much public comment we had. And this is just going to – the whole idea is just going to grow. It is the right place for it, and I'm really excited about it. I'll be way off the board when it happens, but I'm a pet lover too. So, yay, this is going to be great for UNR and the state of Nevada. Keep our students home where they belong.
I couldn't agree with you more. Thank you, Chair. Sorry about that.
Thank you, Chair. I'm also in support of this. I think this is obviously a wonderful addition, and thank you to those in public comment that spoke up. I am curious, though, if you have any – are there any partners in the state that you plan on working with? I don't know what the infrastructure looks like statewide, but I am just curious if there's a plan and if there are already existing partners.
So, Regent Brown, thank you for the question. I mean, we don't have any – partnerships on paper and things that we have solidified at this point, but we have talked again from the Humane Society that is desperate for veterinarians and would love to have clinical rotations through their facilities, to Liberty Dogs in Reno, to equine services across the state, including Clark County. I did not know that one of the largest shortages of equine veterinary services is in Clark County, Nevada. That's something I have learned. And again, with the Department of Agriculture, we have a lot of potential partners lined up. And with your approval at some point, we will move forward.
That makes sense. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
And, Mr. Chair, if I could just add, this is Brian Sandoval for the record for Regent Brown. We wanted to be very careful that we didn't get out ahead of this board in terms of establishing any formal partnerships. We wanted to make sure we did this first. And then hopefully with your favorable consideration, then we can really hit the ground running. Thank you.
And that totally makes sense. And maybe I should have just rephrased it, because obviously one of my favorite things that I hear any of our institutions that has a external partner has a business pipeline that can get folded right into not just externships, but also, you know, feeding into it. So I think that was more of not specifics, but like, I'm assuming that's the plan. That's, you know, we're going to build towards it. And, please, once, hopefully it gets approved. And, once there are more plans, we look forward to those announcements.
And I would like to add, in addition, I mean, we have also spoken with the schools and colleges that have veterinary nursing, veterinary technician, just to explore how this might work with the College of Veterinary Medicine going forward. So we're having discussions with institutions in our system also.
Regent Downs?
Thank you, Chair Arascata. I also want to lend my support to this. I think it's a great idea. It's about time. I've known people personally who've had to leave the state to go pursue their passion in this area. So it would be great to have this. I guess my question is, what will this come back to us in the near future for approval, or is this just going to be more of you got our verbal consent and now you want to just start the planning process? What are the next steps?
Our next step would be to bring this forward for your approval with the full plan at the June meeting.
Thank you. I look forward to that.
I like the ambition. One of the items that was brought up on your presentation on one of the slides was the cost. I believe it was $26,000. The feasibility, here it is, feasibility slide, page 5 of 12, and it states that the cost structure, the competitive tuition, approximately $26,000. Is that semester total? What is that $26,000?
Thank you, Regent Arascata, for your question. That's $26,000 a year, and that is based on what other regional public veterinary schools are charging to the east of us. But also with that cost structure and what we think we can support in terms of the class size, there will be a significant part of our planning on what is the cost model for the complete school.
Wonderful. Just a donor enthusiasm, philanthropic infusion, and what you have here in the state and the support that you have through all veterinarian services. And as is brought up with Liberty Dogs up here in Reno, yeah, this is a wonderful project. University of Nevada, thank you very much. Provost Thompson, well done. And thank you for all involved.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to move over to new business items. Items for consideration at future meetings may be suggested here. Are there any new business items from the committee members of the South?
Chair Regent Brown.
Please.
I would like to ask to bring back the intellectual property item with different options for the board to consider that might include a unified tech transfer office and different breakdowns of how the distribution would be allocated.
Thank you, Regent Brown. Regent Batista, Regent Del Carlo, new business items?
No, thank you.
Regent Downs?
No, thank you, Chair.
Very similar to what my peer, Regent Brown, just mentioned. The agenda item, time to greet, for a future agenda item number 9 and number 11 to be brought back to us. Number 9, of course, is the one that was just referenced of the intellectual property. And agenda item number 11 is the time to degree program. I think those both unquestionably need to be readdressed well before our next quarterly meeting, most likely during a special meeting. Hopefully everyone can get this.